next. Fortunately, Jack didn't have to cluster around the buffet tables and gobble his lunch with the others while the pianist offered the inevitable salute to Eva Perone. Jack had a permanent reserve table at the Bellomondo, secured by offering the maitre d' a crisp new $100 bill every day. A good meal and a few double whiskeys would come in about right. It had been a lousy morning anyway. CBS commentators had jabbered right through most of Jimmy Carter's seconding speech for Hartman, and the other networks had cut away for commercials. Chairman Jim Wright, who Jack figured wanted Hartman to win, had cued the band to play Stars and Stripes Forever at the end of the speech, which got the audience up for a massive floor demonstration that those watching TV had entirely missed. Jack could have sworn he heard Devon's screams all the way from the Marriott. Jack was beginning to believe, in a purely superstitious way, in the existence of a secret ace who was out to get Hartman, or maybe just gremlins from the Kremlin. "Jack! Mr. Braun!" An avuncular Father Christmas figure rolled toward him, a straw pork pie hat shadowing his long white hair and straggly beard. Louis Manxman, a reporter for the LA Times who had been aboard Hartman's campaign plan from the start. There was a purposeful look in the newsman's eye. "Hi, Louis." Jack tucked his briefcase under one arm, jammed his hands into the pockets of his Banana Republic photojournalist jacket, and tried to skate past. Manxman moved purposefully to block him and grinned up through metal-rimmed bifocals. "I want the story on that test vote Monday night." "Ancient history, Louis. The papers have been praising Danny Logan's masterful strategy, the way he put it together at the last minute. Even Devon didn't know what was happening. You should have seen his face when he realized. But I know Logan from way back, and it doesn't seem like his kind of move at all. I've talked to every delegate head I could find, and they all say their orders came from you, not Logan." "Logan knew what I was doing." Jack tried to move left. Manxman moved to block. "A source told me the old Mick was passed out Monday night. He was celebrating." Moving right. "Celebrating from breakfast on, from what I hear." Blocking. Jack glared at him. "I'm a busy man, Louis. What the hell do you want, anyway?" "Was it you or wasn't it?" "I will not confirm or deny, okay?" "Why deny it? You're a Hollywood boy. You should relish the publicity. Don't be such a weenie." Jack stopped for a moment and wondered if weenie was going to be the operative word for this convention. The inevitable happened, and the man in the white tuxedo pounded out the opening bars of "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina." Jack felt his temper fraying. "I'm late for lunch, Louis. I won't confirm or deny. That's for the record. That's my statement. Got that?" The Santa Claus look was gone. 40 years too late to take the fifth, Jack. Anger snarled in Jack. He fixed the reporter in a cold stare and stepped forward as if to walk right through him. There and nearing the white piano on its pedestal, the man in the white tuxedo was still ringing through his paean to South American fascism. Anger began to roil in Jack, in the wake of fear and humiliation. He said goodbye to Amy, then stepped up to the piano. The man in the white tuxedo gave him an automatic smile. There was a big fishbowl on the piano, with a green drift of tip money in the bottom. Jack reached for the rim of the glass, exerted just slightly, and cracked off a hand-sized piece. His golden force field fluttered slightly. The piano man stared. Jack pulverized the glass in his hand, then reached forward, opened the front pocket of the man's jacket, and poured the glass inside. "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina" died away. "Play that song again," Jack said, "and I'll kill you." Walking away, Jack felt he ought to be ashamed of this brand of cheap satisfaction. Somehow he wasn't.
12 noon. Troll was Chrysalis's only pallbearer. The massive security chief from the Jokertown Clinic cradled the coffin in his arms as if it were a sleeping child and led the procession into the churchyard. More prayers were said, and Father Squid blessed the grave with incense and holy water. Tachyon scooped up a handful of dirt and dribbled it slowly onto the coffin. It gave back a hollow, scrabbling sound like claws on glass, and Tachyon shuddered. The sun looked bloated and somehow diseased as it floated in the pall of a smoggy New York summer day. Tach longed for the end. The dead had been buried. Now Atlanta was beckoning, but there was still the receiving line to be endured, and 30 minutes of human handshakes. Tack decided to spare himself some of the grossities. He pulled out a pair of red kid gloves and worked them over his slim white hands. "Hello, Father," said a familiar voice to his left.
Good to see you again, Daniel.
Takian couldn't restrain himself. He flung himself into Brennan's arms, hugging the human with a fierce grip and a show of naked emotion that he knew the man was only tolerating. With a sharply indrawn breath, Tak held Brennan at arm's length and eyed him critically.
We must talk. Come.
They walked deeper into the graveyard until they were partly shielded by several intricate tombstones. Takian peered around a weeping angel at the woman who stared curiously after them.
The beautiful blonde must be Jennifer.
Yes, said Brennan.
I'd say you're a lucky man, but that would seem less than apt when you're being framed for murder. Is that what brought you back?
Partly. Mostly I'm here to find who killed her.
And how are you progressing?
Not too well.
Any theories?
I thought Kian might have done it.
Takian shook his head. That makes no sense. We had a deal that took you out of the city and ended the war. Why would he risk restarting the whole killing cycle?
Who knows? I'm just going to keep poking until something jumps.
Dryly, Tak said, just make sure it doesn't jump on you. I wish I could aid you, but I must return to Atlanta. You will keep in touch.
No. Once I finish this, Jennifer and I are leaving New York, and this time it'll be for good.
If you won't keep in touch, at least be careful.
That I can agree to.
1 p.m. Piedmont Park was packed. Spectre shouldered his way through the crowd toward the podium. He felt like an idiot in the tight black and white outfit. His skin was suffocating under the grease paint. He'd barely made it to the park on time. The costume shop had been wall-to-wall bodies, mostly jokers. Luckily, the gathering in the park had emptied the streets. He'd left his clothes and other belongings in a locker. The key was tucked under the wrist of his leotard. He was still a good 100 yards from the podium. They'd done a mic test, but so far, no Hartman. A shadow moved slowly over the crowd. Spectre looked up, shading his eyes from the glare, and saw the turtle gliding noiselessly over them toward the stage, which was being prepared for the senator's speech. There was applause and a small cheer. The crowd was mostly jokers, although there were a few groups of gnats clustered at the edges.
Look, Mommy, a funny man.
A young joker girl pointed at Spectre. She was sitting in a beat-up stroller holding a flower. Her arms and legs were rail thin and knobbed up and down. They looked like they'd been broken 20 times each. Spectre gave a weak smile, hoping the grease paint around his lips made it seem bigger than it was. The girl's mother smiled back. Patterns of blotchy red pigment crept across her skin. As Spectre watched, one of the circles closed into a small dot and erupted blood. The woman wiped it away in a quick, embarrassed motion. She took the flower from her daughter's hand and held it out to Spectre. Spectre reached out and took it, being careful not to touch her flesh. Being a gnat in a crowd of jokers, even dressed as a mime, gave him the creeps. He turned away.
Do something funny,
the little girl said.
Mommy, make him do something funny.
There was a murmur of approval from the crowd. Spectre turned slowly and tried to think. Funny was something he'd never been accused of being. He tried balancing the flower on the tip of a finger. Amazingly, he was able to. There was dead silence. Sweat dripped over his painted brows and into his eyes. He was breathing hard. It was still very quiet. A gloved hand flashed before Spectre's face, snatching the flower. It placed the stem between painted lips and struck an affected pose. Laughter from the crowd. The other mime, bowed low, and raised up slowly. Spectre took a step back. The other mime quickly grabbed him by the elbow and shook his head. More giggles from the crowd. This was the last thing Spectre needed. Not only was he the center of attention, but he was still a long way from where he needed to be. Hartman might start up any second, and Spectre wouldn't be able to get through in time. The other mime looked down, made a face, and pointed at Spectre's feet. Spectre glanced down instinctively and saw nothing there, just as the mime's hand came up under his chin and popped his head back. This got the biggest laugh of all. The mime clutched at his sides and laughed noiselessly. Spectre rubbed his mouth. He'd bitten his tongue. He gritted his teeth under the painted-on smile. The other mime placed a finger on the top of Spectre's head and danced around him like a maypole. He stopped in front of Spectre, tugged at his cheeks. Spectre had put up with enough. It was time to get this fucker out of his hair. He stepped in close and made eye contact. He locked in and set the pain free, grabbing the mime's shoulders as he began to fall over. Spectre lowered him slowly, pulling the mime's hands together over his chest. The shithead's eyes were glazed over with death and surprise by the time he came to rest on the trampled grass. Spectre stuck the flower in the corpse's hands and applauded melodramatically. The crowd laughed and cheered. Some patted him on the back, others looked at the mime, waiting for him to get up.
"My friends!"
The amplified voice came from the podium. The crowd turned. Spectre angled his shoulders and began pushing through.
"Today we will have the privilege to hear from the only man who can lead us through these next difficult years. A man who preaches tolerance, not hatred. A man who unites instead of being divisive. A man who will lead his people, not herd them. I give you the next president of the United States of America, Senator Greg Hartman."
The applause was deafening. There were weird screams and whistles, joker noises. Spectre caught an elbow in the ear from a freak with arms that hung to his knees. He shook it off and kept moving in. "Thank you." Hartman paused while the applause and cheers played out. "Thank all of you very much." Spectre could see him now, but there was no way to lock eyes at this distance, even if Hartman was looking right at him. The crowd was pressing in toward the podium. Spectre rode the flood of human mistakes, used his narrow shoulders to cut through. Another minute or two and he'd be in position. "It has been said that I am a pro-Joker candidate." Hartman raised his hands to still the applause before it could start. "That is not strictly true. I have always placed one idea above all others, that this country should exist as our founding fathers planned it. Equal rights for all, guaranteed, under the law of the land. No individual greater than the next, no one, however powerful, exempt from the law." Hartman paused. The crowd applauded again. Spectre was about 100 feet away in the center of the crowd. Hartman was wearing a beige suit. A slight breeze stirred at his styled hair. Secret Service agents flanked the podium, their eyes hidden behind sunglasses. The senator's gaze swept the crowd, but missed Spectre. It would take total concentration to lock on for the instant they had eye contact, if that even happened.
"I need your help to win our party's nomination and become your next president."
Hartman extended his hands to the crowd.
"Your presence here in Atlanta can help me only if you demonstrate in an orderly manner. Any acts of violence whether provoked or not, will certainly be used against us. You have the opportunity to make a simple but eloquent statement. A statement made by Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. That violence is an abhorrent act. That it will not be tolerated by you under any circumstance.
Hartman's eyes were drifting across the crowd again, headed straight for him. Spectre held his breath and concentrated, the pain howling in his head. Just a little more. Spectre stood on his toes, their eyes locked. There was a sound. A Secret Service man knocked Hartman down. Gunfire. There were screams and people tried to move, but were packed too closely together. Spectre looked at a hilltop. There were maybe 100 men in Confederate uniforms. Puffs of smoke came from their guns, then the echo of the shots across the park. Hartman was gone. There wouldn't be another chance. Not here, anyway. Spectre jumped in, behind a joker who was as broad as 3 normal men. Didn't matter where he was going. It would be safer than here. The turtle whooshed by overhead. There were a few more rounds and then the gunfire stopped. Spectre stepped on something that cracked. There was a groan. He held onto the joker's leather belt, which had "Wide Load" painted on in gold. No shit, Spectre thought. But this was one time he was glad to have a fat freak as company.
6 p.m. From the end of the corridor, Mackie watched the tall, thin man with coffee and cream skin close and lock the room door. 1531, just as Der Mann said. It came to him that America was decadent, even as his departed comrades of the Red Army fraction used to say. Where else in the world might a man see a nigger wrap himself in a suit that cost more money than Mackie Messer had ever owned at one time in his life, and stroll out upon the town with a white woman on his arm? To himself, he laughed at his target's apparent attempt at disguise. She looked just like one of the Reeperbahnstrasse girls, armored against unaccustomed daylight. It was appropriate. Just a whore. Just another fucking whore. Who had lured the man, and would pay. They turned away from him, toward the elevators. He pushed off from the wall next to the fire extinguisher under glass. He couldn't do them here. He was already thinking, them. It was only logical. He mustn't leave a witness. Because this crazy bourgeois palace was hollow at the core, like the culture that built it, and anyone on one of a dozen levels could see everything that went on out on the catwalks surrounding the atrium. His move had to come on the quiet. Der Mann had been very explicit. But that was no problem. Mack the Knife was subtle like his song. He would follow and know the time. Maybe he'd ride the elevator with them. He licked his lips at the joke. That would be really criminel. They'd never suspect him. They might not notice him even. Perhaps they were in love. Perhaps the black man had a hard-on. He moved. A voice grabbed at him. Hey, you! Not so fast! He turned. A squat white man in a brown suit stood there with a wire hanging out of his ear. Hotel Dick. Mackie had the gradations of cop burned into his autonomic nervous system by the time he was toddling the St. Pauli cobblestones. He had been as discreet as possible, staying back in the entry to the room where the ice machine lurked and clattered to itself, fading through the wall into a utility closet when people got too near. But there was a limit to how covert even MacHeath could be, hanging out here over 60 meters of emptiness in this unsettling outside-in place. The suit laid a hand on his arm. You couldn't do that. Not to Mackie Messer. You're lucky, he said. He touched the man on the point of his cheekbone, buzzed a fingertip. Blood started. The man cried out and doubled over, slapping a hand to his face. Mackie phased through the steel fire door and started running down the stairs. He didn't dare lose his quarry now. Women were always changing their minds. No knowing if she would be returning to this place.
Spectre sat on the edge of the bed, feet tucked underneath him. He was almost surprised to find his room clean when he returned. It had been that long since he stayed in a hotel. He was alternately planning his next move and watching TV. Right now, the television had his attention. A local reporter, trying not to look out of his depth, was interviewing Hartman in the lobby. Senator, do you feel Reverend Barnett had anything to do with this afternoon's disturbance? The reporter held the microphone up to the senator, who paused before replying. No, I think that whatever our differences, Leo Barnett would not stoop to such tactics. The Reverend is an honorable man. Hartman coughed. But I do feel that those individuals who disrupted the meeting likely share many of his dangerously narrow views. It is precisely this kind of unreasoning bigotry that we must all struggle to eliminate. Leo Barnett wants to solve the problem by removing wild-card victims from society. I want to overcome the hatred itself. Hartman sat back in his seat, folded his hands, and stared hard into the camera. The guy's fucking good, said Spectre, but it won't make any difference. The camera cut back to the studio. A black woman reporter turned to her co-anchor. Thanks to Howard for that interesting interview. Dan, what have the police discovered so far about the perpetrators of the disturbance? Not much, I'm afraid. Several of them are in custody, captured by the Turtle, but the police are getting very little cooperation. The reporter tapped his thumbs together. There are rumors that most of them are members of the Ku Klux Klan, but that's been unsubstantiated. Although the disturbance was obviously well planned, none of the individuals involved claims to be the leader of the group. And so far, no clue as to where the authentic Confederate uniforms and muskets came from. The reporter frowned and turned back to the black woman. Well, I'm sure the authorities will keep us posted if any new information comes to light in this bizarre incident. The black woman shook her head. Although dummy ammunition was used, several individuals were hurt in the panic that ensued. The video cut to earlier footage of the panic in the park. The cameraman was running with the rest during the panic, bouncing the picture all over. At least one person, a street performer, was allegedly trampled to death. Ironically, he was believed to be playing dead at the time. His name is being withheld pending notification of next of kin. Fucking A, said Spectre, punching the TV off. He was off the hook for that one anyway. But that didn't get him any closer to Hartman. He'd almost felt something holding him off for the instant that they locked eyes. Nah, just imagination. To do that, he'd have to have powers like the astronomer or Tachyon. Astronomer for president, he giggled. That'd make even Reagan look good by comparison. He popped up off the bed and walked slowly around the carpeted floor, considering his options. Killing Hartman might be more than he was up to. He could take the money and go someplace else, another country maybe. Maybe work for a casino in Cuba. Nope. He'd always done what he was paid to do. Fucking middle-class ethics again. Didn't stop him from killing people, but made him live up to a contract. He sighed and walked to the phone. Tony was his only shot. He'd known that ever since they met in the lobby. It was kismet or something. Didn't stop him from feeling like shit, though. He punched in the number and waited. An unfamiliar female voice answered the phone. "Could I speak to Tony Calderone, please?"
"He's not available right now. Could I take a message?"
The woman sounded tired. "Yes. Tell him James called. He'll know who you mean. Tell him I'd like to firm up that dinner invitation he extended." Spectre was almost surprised at how cool and polite he sounded.
"Yes, James. What was your last name?"
"Just James. He'll know who you mean. I'll give him the message." "Thanks." Spectre hung up the phone and sighed. Maybe he'd order a steak from room service and hope the Peaches were on TV again tonight. If they're America's team, he thought, we're all in a shitload of trouble.
8 p.m. Spotlights dazzled Jack's eyes. The long lenses of television cameras were trained on him like shotguns. An eddy of stage fright turned his knees to liquid. He hadn't done this sort of thing in years. He looked up into the lights, gave the world a crooked grin. Reflexes coming back. Good. And said his line. "The 31st state, the Golden State, is proud to cast its 314 votes for the cause of Joker's rights and the next president, Senator Greg Hartman." A roar. Applause. Silly hats and flying ace gliders took to the air. Jack tried to look noble, cheerful, and triumphant till the spotlights moved off to the state chairman of Colorado. "Take that, Ronald Reagan," he thought. "I'll show you how to work a camera." He climbed down from the little red, white, and blue podium that had been brought in for just this purpose. The guy from Colorado, not sure of his totals, was fumbling his line. Fortunately, Colorado had gone for Dukakis and Jackson. The first ballot gave Hartman 1,622 votes, Barnett 998, with Jackson, Dukakis, and Gore splitting the rest. Nobody was close to winning. Chaos descended on the floor while media commentators made wise judgments and hedged predictions about what would happen next. Rule 9C went out the window once the first ballot was cast and floor managers were promising uncommitted delegates the moon. The second ballot was called early, 30 minutes after the first, just so campaign managers could have enough numbers to see how things were going. Hartman gained about 50 votes, mainly at the expense of Dukakis and Gore. The convention burst into a series of sweaty huddles while media commentators tried to make up their minds whether 50 votes signified a trend toward Hartman or just a lean. Floor managers went into fits at the thought of delegates slipping through their fingers. The pandemonium went on for hours. By the time a sleepy-eyed Jim Wright called for the third ballot just before midnight, the three commercial networks had died of inertia and gone back to their standard summer fare of reruns and Johnny Carson. And only PBS was covering the action for an audience of a few thousand hardcore political junkies. Hartman hit an even 1,800. The trend was solidifying. Hats and gliders zoomed ceilingward. Jack picked up his podium and threw it about 100 feet into the air, a tumbling star-spangled sign of triumph, then reached out and carefully caught it before it could brain somebody. The celebrations in Jack's suite went on for hours. He was stumbling off to bed before he realized that he really should have called Bobby. Even if she turned out to be the starlet with the cellulite obsession, Jack figured he could have given her enough healthful exercise to make her happy.
10 p.m. Peachtree, tiled and echoic. They walked arm in arm. Sarah had drunk 2 glasses of wine. It was the first alcohol she had had for over a year. She had never drunk much liquor, except for the weeks after the tour. Ricky was regaling her with the latest candidate jokes going the rounds. "How about this one? If Dukakis, Hartman, and Brother Leo went boating together on Lake Lanier, and the boat's engine blew up and it sank, who'd be saved? The nation, Sarah said. Last time I heard it, it was Reagan, Carter, and Anderson. But then, you're too young to remember. What goes around comes around, Rosie. But I was old enough to vote in 80, if barely. You probably think I'm a wicked old lady robbing the cradle. She frowned. Where was that coming from? Steady, she told herself. Ricky patted her hand.
I certainly hope so, Rosie.
He laughed then, to show it was a joke. She felt the tension come into her just the same. A thin current of sound was running down the corridor, between the rocks of their laughter. What's that song? She asked. He raised a brow at her.
Don't you know it?
She did, but she'd needed something to say.
It's Mac the Knife, standby of every low-rent lounge singer in the Northern Hemisphere. The Muzak's broken in here, see? So they hired this white dude to walk around and whistle.
She laughed and squeezed his arm briefly. Damn, what am I doing? She looked around, almost as if seeking some external cause for her behavior. Movement behind. Her tongue pushed out between suddenly dry lips. She made her face turn to the side, as if she was admiring the brash fashions draped on the headless silver and black and olive green mannequins posing in a boutique window. Somebody's following us. No, don't look.
Give me some credit, Rosie. I'm a journalist, remember? I didn't sleep through your seminar.
He glanced to the side, then faced forward.
Just some kid in a leather jacket.
A frown spoiled the smooth perfection of his forehead.
Looked like he had a hunchback. Poor son of a bitch.
She looked back again. Now quit that, or you're going to turn into a pillar of salt.
You were the one who wanted subtlety.
I don't like the way he looks, she said. He feels wrong, somehow.
The instincts of a seasoned ace reporter. Well seasoned.
Is that a crack about my age?
The wine you drank.
He patted her hand.
That's the spirit. Whistling past a graveyard, like. Walk on. Keep your head up. Never let them see you're afraid. It unleashes all those primitive Nordic predatory instincts.
She fought her neck muscles, which were trying to rotate her head toward the leather boy. You think he could be one of Barnett's little helpers?
Been known to happen during this convention, Rosie. Wouldn't that be an irony? To get jumped on suspicion of being Hartman fans.
This time she did look back. He was sauntering along, hands in pockets. First the white shoe, then the black. Ricky was right. One shoulder definitely rode higher than the other. There was something a little too elaborate about the way he wasn't paying attention to them. At least he's small. But then, Ricky wasn't exactly Arnold Schwarzenegger. Once around a curve, Ricky grabbed her hand and they took off running, Sarah wobbling on her ingenue heels, Ricky's Gucci's slapping the rubber runner. The passageway wound round and around. She kept looking back, saw no sign of pursuit. They slowed, Sarah puffing for breath, Ricky gracious enough to pretend to be winded.
One more turn and we're back in the Hyatt, Ricky said. Another potentially ugly confrontation avoided. That's how we 80s types handle things.
They turned the bend, and there he was, leaning with his back and his cheek against cool tile, sizing them up. He started to whistle. Mac the Knife. Sarah grabbed Ricky's wrist and hauled him back around out of sight.
I'm not sure that's a good idea, Rosie, he said. We should just bluff our way past.
Don't you see? The terror was upon her. It glowed in her eyes like white-hot wires. How did he get in front of us?
Some kind of service passage. We're right near the hotel. If he causes trouble, we can make a lot of noise and someone will come rescue us.
And then he came out of the wall at them, lunging like a shark. Like a dancer, Ricky swung Sarah behind him.
What the hell do you think you're doing? party, party, the boy said with a Hans and Franz accent, laughing, spraying spittle from loose lips. Everybody get down tonight. There was a buzzing in the air, oppressive as the humid night outside Peachtree Center's artificial chill. The boy swung a hand karate fashion for the side of Ricky's neck. Ricky wasn't a racquetball ace for nothing. Nothing wrong with his reflexes. He blocked with a spidery forearm. The hand went through it. There was a savage, shrilling moment, like a buzzsaw hitting a knot in a plank. And then Ricky's forearm and splayed hand just sort of toppled. Ricky stood staring at the red hoop of blood springing out the suit-coated stump. Sarah screamed. Ricky pointed his arm, hosing his own blood into his assailant's eyes. The boy fell back, sputtering and swiping at his face. Ricky hurled himself at him, windmill arms whirling. Rosie, run! Her legs would not move. Ricky was pummeling the boy with stump and inexpert fist. It looked like the worst of playground bullying. Ricky was a head taller, with a good 6 inches reach. That sound came again. She knew she would hear it every time she closed her eyes for the rest of her life. She smelled something like burned hair. Ricky's arm fell off at the shoulder. His blood vomited over the wall, white with a mosaic sprinkling of blue and green and yellow. He turned a martyr's face to her. Rosie, he said, and his gums were shocks of blood. Please run! For God's sake, run! The hand passed playfully. His lower jaw was sheared away with the rest of his words. His tongue flopped at her, unmoored, a ghastly parody of lust. She turned and fled, the charnel house sound pursuing. As she rounded the corner, the heel of her left shoe snapped. She went to her knee with an impact like a gunshot. She skidded 20 feet, bounced off a wall. She tried to struggle up. Her leg would not carry her. She fell heavily against the tile. Oh, Ricky, she sobbed. I'm sorry. Sorry for blowing the escape he had bought her with his life. Sorry for the strange, guilty surge of relief down underneath the terror that she would not have to face the question that another night in his room would bring between them. She began to push herself along with her hands, knees up, scooting sideways on her rump. He came around the corner, looking 12 feet tall. Blood splashed his leather and his skin, unnaturally bright in the fluorescent light. He was smiling around teeth like a collapsing fence. Der Mann sends his regards. Single-mindedly, she sculled away from him. There was nothing in the world but the motions of a losing race. And voices down the corridor, welling up from where the passage from the Hyatt dipped under Center Avenue. A party of delegates in Jackson buttons appeared, black, middle-aged, well-dressed, talking happily amongst themselves about their candidate's last-minute upsurge at day's end. The killer in leather raised his head. A brief pigeon of a woman in a salmon dress with a bow beneath capacious breasts looked up, saw him with the blood upon him and his victims strewn into the corridor bend behind. She jammed fists beneath her eyes and screamed like hell. The boy's eyes blazed at Sarah. Remember Jenny Towler, he snarled, and walked through the wall.
11 p.m. Mine! Puppet Man felt the searing, twisted menace approaching. Greg turned as Mackie ghosted through the wall of his bedroom, a crooked smile set above his crooked shoulders. There was a splotchy brown-red stain on his right hand up to the elbow that could only be one thing. Mine!
All the fucking hotel rooms look the same, Mackie said.
Get the hell out of here, Greg snapped. Mackie's grin slid from his punched face.
I wanted to tell you, he said, the German accent broader than usual. I offed the nigger, but the woman...
Mine! He's mine! Greg was surprised that he was able to hear Mackie's voice over Puppet Man at all. The power slammed relentlessly against Greg's hold, again and again and again. Mackie's raw, violent insanity radiated wildly, leaking from the boy's pores with an odor of decomposing meat and spreading out in front of Puppet Man like a rotting banquet. Greg had to get Mackie away quickly, or the tenuous hold he had on himself would be entirely gone. Out! Greg repeated desperately. Ellen's here! Mackie's mouth twisted, a sneer. He fidgeted, restlessly shifting his weight from foot to foot.
Yeah, I know, in the other room, watching goddamn TV. They were showing Chrysalis's funeral. I saw her, but she didn't see me. Oh, I could have buzzed her easy.
He licked his lips. His nervous stare flicked across Greg's body like a whip as Puppet Man hammered again at the bars.
I don't know where Morgenstern is, he said at last.
Then go find her.
I wanted to see you,
Mackie whispered it like a lover. A voice of velvet sandpaper. The lust was honey-syruped, golden and rich and sweet. Puppet Man screeched in need. The bars in Greg's mind started to crumble.
Get out of here, he hissed between clenched teeth. You didn't get Downs. Now you tell me you can't find Sarah. What the hell good are you to me? You're just a useless punk, with or without your race.
He'd always been easy with Mackie, placating the kid, feeding his ego. Even with Puppet Man controlling the hunchback's emotions, he'd been afraid of Mackie. Using him was like juggling nitroglycerin. It looked easy, but he was aware that he would only get one mistake. Greg thought he might have made it now. Mackie's face had gone grim and cold. The lust did a quicksilver change to something simpler and more dangerous. Mackie's right hand was beginning to vibrate unconsciously as a threatening whine shivered the air.
No, Mackie said, shaking his head. You don't know. You're the man. I love...
Greg cut him off. If there was going to be an explosion, it might as well be a big one.
I told you to take out two people who are a danger to us. They're both walking around now while you're telling me how good you are and how much I mean to you.
Mackie blinked, twitched.
You're not listening.
No, I'm not. And I won't listen until all the loose ends are taken care of. You understand that? Mackie took a halting step toward Greg, his hand up. The fingers were a dangerous blur. Greg stared him down. It was absolutely the hardest thing he'd ever done. Puppet Man was a berserk thing behind his eyes, gibbering and frothing with the closeness of Mackie and the emotional backwash spilling around him. Greg knew that he had only seconds before Puppet Man surfaced entirely, before the mental bonds reversed, and he would be the one underneath. Yet while he held Puppet Man, there were no controls on Mackie, and no way to dampen the madness. If the ace took another step, if he swiped at Greg with that hand... Greg shuddered with effort. Come to me afterward, Mackie, he whispered. After it's all done. Not before. Mackie lowered his hand, his eyes. The red violence around him faded slightly.
All right,
he said softly.
You're the man. Yes.
He reached out with his hand, safely quiet now, and Greg fought the impulse to back away and run. He concentrated on holding Puppet Man for just a moment longer. Mackie's dry fingertips traced Greg's cheek with a strange tenderness, dragging across stubble. Greg closed his eyes. When he opened them again, Mackie was already gone.
Drawing his fingers down the strings, Tachyon pulled a sigh of music from the violin. The Secret Service agent swung his head in that heavy, slow way of a bull confronting an irritant. Tack nodded politely to him. The man brightened considerably, cast a furtive glance over his shoulder, and quick-stepped to where the alien was sitting cross-legged on the floor outside Fleur's room. Sounds of revelry drifted down the hall from a nearby room party. Hi. Hello. My daughter's crazy about you, and she'll kill me if she finds out I met you and hadn't gotten your autograph. Would you mind? No, I'd be delighted. Tack pulled a notebook from his pocket. Her name? Trina? For Trina, with love. And he signed his name with a flourish. Excuse me, but what are you doing out here?
I'm going to play the violin for the lady in that room.
Oh, little romance, huh?
I hope. I won't make any trouble, sir. May I stay?
The agent shrugged. Yeah, what the hell? But if people complain...
Not to worry.
Tack lifted his bow, tucked the violin beneath his chin. A few years ago, he had arranged Chopin's Etude in A-flat for solo violin. The notes fell from the strings like crystal beads, like water chuckling over stones. But beneath the joy was a strain of sadness.
The faces of women, blithe, angel face, roulette, fleur, chrysalis. Farewell, old friend.
The door to the hotel room was flung violently open. Tack stared up into her smoldering brown eyes.
Hello, my love.
What are you doing? Why won't you leave me alone? Please, please, just leave me alone. Her hair flew about her face.
I can't.
She was on her knees before him, hands gripping his shoulders. Why not?
It makes no sense to me. How shall I explain it to you?
You've twisted and corrupted everything you've ever touched. Now you're trying to do it to me. He didn't deny it. Couldn't deny it.
I think we could make each other well. Wash away the guilt.
Only God has that power.
He tentatively touched a strand of hair with the tip of a finger. You have her face. Can it be that you don't have her soul?
You damn fool! You've made her into something that never existed!
She jerked her head away. His fingers trailed across her cheek and he felt moisture. The violent withdrawal carried her a few steps to his left. Fleur leaned her forehead against the wall, every line of her body etched in agony. Tack laid the bow across the strings. Played.
12 midnight. In the latex clown head's mask, Greg was simply another of the jokers trying to stay cool in the sticky Atlanta humidity. The temperature was stuck permanently in the low 90s. The breeze felt like a moving sauna. The mask was an oven, but he didn't dare take it off. It had taken time to arrange his escape from the hotel. Ellen had finally gone to sleep, but there was no telling when she might wake. He hated taking the risk, but he had to do something about Puppet Man. The power had gained the strength of desperation. Greg was afraid that its struggles were already too visible to outsiders. Discarded flying ace gliders transformed into fucking flying jokers crumpled underfoot as Greg stepped over the gutter and into Piedmont Park. Shapes moved through the trees and around the grassy hillocks. Police swept the perimeter with regularity, trying to keep the jokers in and anyone else out. But it was easy enough for Greg to slide past them in the darkness and enter the surreal world of the park. Once inside, the city at his back was forgotten. A tent village had sprung up on one of the hillsides, spreading shouting laughter and light. A bonfire flickered close by. He could hear singing. The jokers passing in front of the fire threw long, shifting shadows across the grass. Deeper in the park behind the peaked tents, Greg saw erratic phosphorescent brilliance. There were enough jokers whose skin glowed, flashed, or radiated that it had become a nightly custom for them to gather on a hilltop at full dark like human fireflies. A UPI photographer's shot of them had become one of the more memorable images of the convention outside the convention. Greg navigated through the park under the puppet man's guidance, following the tug of mental strings from the puppets within the crowd. There were many of them in the park, mostly long-time J-Town residents whose neuroses and foibles were familiar and much-traveled territory for Puppet Man. Often he'd ignore them for the thrill that came from twisting some new puppet to his will. But not tonight. Tonight he was after sustenance and an easing of the power's needs, and he'd take the quick, easy path. One of the threads led to Peanut. Peanut, a puppet since the mid-70s, one of those he'd used during the tragedy of the 76 convention. The Joker was a sad, simple-minded man whose skin had been turned brittle, hard, and painful. He'd been Gimli's associate within the defunct JJS, and his right arm had been hewn off by Mackie Messer just over a year ago. Peanut had come between Mackie and the Nur al-Ala's sister, Kahina. Arrested with others in the organization after Gimli's death, Peanut had been quickly released after Greg's office interceded on his behalf. Peanut had always been troubled by his friend Gimli's deep hatred of Greg. Peanut had admired the Hardman he knew. After his release, he even worked as a volunteer for the New York City campaign staff, canvassing the Jokertown district during the primary. Peanut was like an old lover. Greg knew all the buttons to push. No one paid much attention to Greg. Most of the Jokers went barefaced, flaunting their Jokerhood. But enough of them still wore the masks that Greg was not overly conspicuous. He lingered at the edge of the tents, on the fringes of the crowd around the bonfire. He sat against a tree bearing a wind-tattered Free Snotman poster. Sweat rained from his face onto the headlands of his black dog t-shirt. He could see Peanut off to his right. Greg dropped the bars around Puppet Man. The restraints faded far too fast, emphasizing just how feeble was his hold on the power. Puppet Man lanced out toward Peanut, examining the colors of the Joker's dim mind and looking for something tasty. The hues of Peanut's mind were simple and plain. It was easy to separate the strands and find the ones Puppet Man could use. With Peanut, as with so many of the Jokers he'd taken, those strands were linked to sex. Puppet Man knew that no matter how they might deny it, most Jokers loathed their appearance. They hated the thing they saw in the mirror. Many found other Jokers just as repulsive. Fortunato had been one of dozens who profited from that truth. There was a vigorous, thriving market in Jokertown for gnat prostitutes willing to entertain Joker customers. Peanut suffered as much as anyone from the stigma. His body tissues were unpliable and ridged. His face looked as if he'd slathered mud over it and then baked it in the sun. At the joints of his limbs, the skin often cracked and split, leaving pus-filled, slow-healing sores and scabs. Peanut was ugly, and Peanut was just smart enough to realize how slow-witted he was. For a gnat, that was an unhappy combination. In Jokertown especially, it was far worse. For Peanut, Greg knew, sex was a rare mingling of pain and pleasure. His erections hurt, and the leathery skin there cracked and bled from the friction of sexual contact. For days afterward, he'd suffer. Yet the wild card hadn't dampened the urges or stopped him from craving the release the act brought. If anything, his drive was stronger than normal. Peanut was a regular customer of the cheapest J-Town whores. When he couldn't afford even their business-like ministrations, he'd masturbate in his flop quickly and guiltily. Puppet Man knew that. Knew it well. There were many times that Puppet Man thought the wild card had been designed strictly for his benefit. Caressing Peanut's mind, he saw the pulsing yellow of lust and knew that it had been days for him. The urge was there, already strong. Puppet Man reached out, slowly brightening the color and saturating it until there was room for little else. Greg, watching, saw Peanut grimace. The Joker rose and walked away from the fire. Greg waited, then followed behind. There were tints and shades within the golden primary, an orange wash of muted sadism, the azure desire for gnats, a coral green preference for oral stimulation. Puppet Man had seen such facets in every puppet. Desire was always complicated and sometimes contradictory. Normally such things remained subdued or even denied, stuff of fantasies and masturbatory visions, minor whirls in the flood. But Puppet Man could make the tendencies flare, make them dominant passions. He could force someone to become a violent rapist or a humiliated slave. He could make them seduce a child or a friend's spouse. It was a favorite trick. Do whatever you want. Just make it quick. Remember Gimli. Puppet Man snarled at the reminder. He prodded brutally at Peanut's mind and waited to see what would happen. Peanut wandered to the edge of the encampment where a stand of trees held darkness. He seemed agitated, his whole body turning as he glanced from side to side. Greg watched from the cover of one of the tents as Peanut seemed to come to a decision and headed into the trees. Greg pursued. He almost ran into the Joker. Peanut had stopped a few yards into the woods. Greg could hear what had caused him to halt. The panting groans could be only one thing. Peanut was standing motionless, watching the hidden Joker couple as they screwed. The colors of his mind were confused, uncertain. Puppet Man touched him again.
Feel it. You can't just stand there and watch. Look at her. Look at her legs wrapped around him. See how she moves her ass under him, lifting her hips so he drives in deeper, eager and hot and wet. That could be you. You want her. You want to feel her legs tighten around your hips. You want to feel your cock deep in her warmth. You want to hear her sighing in your ear and telling you to fuck her. Fuck her deep and hard and good until you explode inside her.
Peanut tugged at his belt buckle with his one hand. The Joker's pants pooled around his ankles.
But she won't want you. Not Peanut. You're disgusting and ugly. All hard edges. You're stupid. She'd be disgusted. She'd feel dirty and violated.
Puppet Man could feel the lust and anger building in concert. He orchestrated it, adding pressure until he felt it simmering.
You'd have to be the master. It's what you want, what she wants. I know you. I know what you've thought when you stroke yourself.
Puppet Man was sighing himself, ready, ready to feed at last. Peanut squatted down, hunting in the underbrush. When he straightened, Greg could see a thick branch clutched in his fist. The Joker raised the weapon.
Go ahead. Hit him and take the bitch. You want it. You must.
And Greg heard deep, mocking laughter.
Gimli! Where are you, damn you? Greg cursed. Where are you hiding?
Why, right here, Greggy. Right here.
Gimli laughed, and in that moment the dwarf's wall slammed up as it had every time these past few weeks. Puppet Man howled in frustration as the strings to Peanut were suddenly, jarringly severed.
No!
The shout might have been Greg, might have been Puppet Man. Puppet Man flung himself against the mental barrier, trying to break through before it was too late. Peanut, startled, turned to see the figure in the clown mask. The stick dropped from his hand as the pair on the ground struggled to their feet.
What's the matter, Greggy? Can't control your goddamn pet?
Puppet Man, exhausted and weak, cowered inside. Greg fled, panicky at being seen. He'd never been caught before, never been noticed. Branches whipped at him as he ran blindly. Peanut shouted after him in alarm. But there was no escape from Gimli's voice. Gimli was always there. As Greg shoved his way through the tent encampment, as he stumbled from the park back into the streets, as he found his way back to the Marriott.
How much longer can you hold him, Greggy?
The dwarf taunted.
A day? Maybe two? Then the bastard's going to fucking eat you. Puppet Man's going to tear loose and fucking eat you whole.
Spectre couldn't see them across the lobby, but he knew they were there. A knot of people. Hartman and his entourage were moving toward him. There wasn't much noise. Spectre took a step out to meet them. People were looking in his direction without noticing him. His pulse quickened as they got closer. Cameras flashed around Hartman. Hartman held out his hand to Spectre. Spectre reached out and noticed he was wearing white gloves and a black leotard. People began to laugh and point. Spectre gritted his teeth and locked eyes with the senator. He could feel Hartman's blood boiling with pain, his ragged breathing, his heart trip-hammering into oblivion. An instant of satisfaction, then it was over. He fell to the floor. Absolute silence. The camera flashes continued, strobing around them. Spectre kicked him over with his foot. It was Tony. His face was horrible, caught in a last scream. Hartman laughed, and Spectre looked up. He was surrounded by Secret Service. They drew their guns and pointed them at Spectre. The barrels looked impossibly large. Spectre was opening his mouth to say something when the first shot took his lower jaw off. He tried to back away, but more bullets knocked him off his feet. Pieces of him were being ripped away. One of his eyes went dark. He'd been shot before, but it had never been like this. He could feel the rain of slugs pushing his body across the floor. Several of his fingers were gone off one hand. He held up the other in front of his face. It was still perfectly white, not a drop of blood on it. His other eye went dark. He screamed and rolled off the bed, then crawled underneath it. There was no sound of gunfire. He moved his lower jaw and hands. His eyes adjusted slowly to the dark. Spectre slid out from under the bed and turned on the table lamp. He was alone in the room. The air conditioner kicked on. He jumped. Fucking nightmare. He shook his head and pulled himself back up onto the bed. Jesus, what a fucking nightmare. He fumbled for the TV control and switched it on. It was another old movie. He recognized John Wayne. For some reason, seeing the Duke calmed him down. He reached under the night table and pulled out his bottle of whiskey. There was barely half a swallow left. He picked up the phone to order another bottle from room service. Tomorrow he was going to find someplace else to stay. Somebody was going to miss the real Herbert Baird soon. And Spectre didn't want to be staying in his room when the police came knocking. He could call the hotel from wherever it was he wound up staying to see if Tony had left a message. He wished like hell it was all over and he was back in Jersey.
Chapter 4, Thursday, July 21st, 1988. 1 a.m.
You bastard!
The bow fell from the strings with a discordant squeal. Hiram glared down at Tachyon. His eyes, buried in pasty rolls of fat, glared red.
Hiram, it is late. We're all under a good deal of stress, so I'm going to ignore that.
Worcester struggled visibly for control and then said,
I've left 27 messages for you starting on Tuesday evening.
Tachyon clapped a hand to his forehead. Oh, ancestors. Hiram, forgive me. Today, yesterday, he amended, checking his watch. I was in New York for the funeral.
Did you see Jay?
Asked Worcester.
Jay. Aykroyd.
Memory kicked in. Jay Aykroyd, a small-time private investigator, part-time ace, and full-time friend of Hiram's. He was some kind of projecting teleport who had used his power on Wildcard Day 1986 to rescue Tachyon out of a ticklish situation.
Oh, him? No.
Come with me. We have a major problem. One I think only you can solve. Thank God it doesn't seem to be too late. If it had been, you really would have something to feel guilty about.
Tachyon snapped shut the violin case and fell into step with Hiram.
So, what is this all about?
Worcester kept his voice very low.
Chrysalis hired an assassin.
What?
The big man snapped his fingers in front of Tachyon's face.
Wake up, Tachyon!
Blood and line. I can't believe this.
Believe it! Jay is seldom wrong about things like this, even if he's somehow mistaken. Can we afford to take a chance?
Cold lead seemed to have settled into the pit of Tack's stomach.
Have we any idea of the target?
Jay thinks it's Barnett, but for safety's sake, I think we can't rule out anyone. Security must be increased on all of the candidates. Our problem is how to alert the Secret Service without revealing all that we know. My God, it would all be lost then.
Hiram's voice faded to a basso rumble. The words lost meaning, and Tack sat in a private hell staring at the knuckles of his right hand as they slowly turned white.
He killed Chrysalis, and now he's going to kill me. You don't want to believe.
Help me. No! Jesus Christ, have you heard a word I've been saying?
Sweat had formed dark rings beneath the ace's armpits.
What are we going to do?
I'll tell the Secret Service that I was randomly skimming in a crowd and picked up the surface thoughts of the assassin. His intent, but not his target or his method.
Yes, yes, good.
A new worry intruded.
But will they believe you?
They'll believe me. You humans are all so impressed by my mental powers.
He patted Worcester's arm.
Do not worry, Hiram. We will stop him.
It was sheer bravado, and Tack had a feeling that Hiram knew.
5 a.m. You sure this is where you want out, ma'am? The uniformed driver asked, craning to peer through the window at the tent city sprung up like post-rain mushrooms in Piedmont Park. Day was really starting to happen, paling the flames of the occasional campfire dying on the trodden grass. I'm sure, she said, and stepped out. The air was already congealing with a colloid of heat and wet, and diesel fumes, and the smell of secretions, human and not quite. She shut the door. The cruiser pulled away. She resisted the urge to shoot the car a bird. When she'd asked for police protection, they'd just stared at her. Hoping to contain hysteria and speculation, the Atlanta police were stonewalling on the Peachtree murder. Even Ricky's name was being withheld, ostensibly pending notification of his mother in Philadelphia. Sarah's involvement had not been announced either. Perhaps in part as a buy-off gesture, the APD spokeswoman was telling the press that the murdered man's companion was being held under protective custody. Sarah knew full well that the Atlanta police were trying to damp dynamite in a mason jar. The explosion, when it came, was going to be that much worse for the attempt. All the same, she was glad of it. Ricky's colleagues would learn his identity soon enough, and infer that she was the woman who'd been with him when he was slain. She dreaded what would happen then. She didn't even have a stirring of temptation to use the inevitable interrogation to try to expose Hartman. She knew how futile that would be. Tachyon had done his job too well. She put on her broad-brimmed hat, hoisted the strap of her bag higher on her shoulder. The intrepid reporter, now freelance, walking among the wretched of the earth, not to mention the but-ugly, gathering their stories of anguish and repression. An act good for a few hours in the middle of a crowd. She was afraid to be alone. Deathly afraid. She began to limp up the hill.
9 a.m. Greg didn't think he'd slept much at all the night before. The last ballot hadn't been cast until early morning, and then there'd been a mild staff celebration in the green room. He'd broken the 1,800 vote barrier. The hope was that the momentum would swing him to 2,081 and the nomination by evening. 300 votes, piece of cake, Devon had said. And Greg didn't care. He didn't care. Greg stood at the window of his suite looking down at the crowd swirling below in the morning sunshine. Hartman supporters mostly from the hats. He rubbed his eyes, sipping on black coffee in a styrofoam cup. The coffee burned in his stomach. Puppet Man burned in his head. God damn it, you have to feed me, Puppet Man wailed. And with the voice came the presence's agony, that feeling of slow starvation. I can't. Greg could feel that emptiness in his own stomach, a steady craving. I want to, but we can't. You know that. We don't have a fucking choice. Not anymore. Puppet Man clawed at him with mental talons. Greg's fingers clenched the heavy curtains. The sight of people walking in the morning sunshine mocked Puppet Man's hunger. He wanted them. He wanted to leap down like a panther and ravage them. His fingers whitened with the intensity of his grip. Back in New York, Greg began, but Puppet Man cut him off. Now! We won't get to New York for another week. I can't wait that long. You can't wait that long. What the hell do you want me to do?
Greg raged back in desperation. It's not me! It's Gimli! We have to do something about him. Give me another day, Greg pleaded. No! Please! Greg was nearly sobbing. His head throbbed with the pain of holding Puppet Man back. He wanted to rip his skull open and gouge out the demanding power with his bare hands. Soon, then, goddammit! Soon, or I'll make you crawl again. I'll strip you naked and make you beat yourself off in front of the press, do you hear me? I'll eat you if I can't have anyone else. Gimli's right in that. Puppet Man raked his mind again, and Greg gasped with the pain. Leave me alone, he shouted. His knotted fingers tore the curtains from the wall in a fury. They crashed to the ground in a thunder of rods and hooks. Greg hurled his coffee cup across the room, splattering the plush furniture and burning his hand. Just leave me alone, he screamed, his fingers dragging at his face. Greg! Senator! Ellen had come from the bedroom. At the same time, Billy Ray burst in through the hall door. Both of them stared at Greg and the wreckage of the room. Ellen with a stark horror on her face and her hands folded protectively over her stomach. My God, Greg, she said. It was a whisper this time. I heard you arguing. I thought there was somebody else here. Her voice trailed off. Greg blinked, stupidly shocked. For the first time, Greg realized the Puppet Man had spoken out loud. He'd been holding a goddamn out loud conversation with Puppet Man and hadn't known. The horror of it made him moan. Ellen glanced at Ray. Billy looked from Ellen to Greg, stared for long seconds. Then he backed out of the suite, closing the door behind him. Greg was gasping in the middle of the room. He forced his breathing to slow. He tried to shrug, to pretend it had been nothing. Ellen, he began, but couldn't say anything. He was suddenly crying like a child frightened of the dark. Ellen came to him with a brave smile, cradling his head on her shoulder and stroking his hair. It's okay, Greg, she murmured, but he could hear the terror in her voice. It's okay now. Everything's all right. I love you, darling. You just have to rest. Words. Just words. Greg could hear Gimli's laughter, and for just a moment he wondered why Ellen seemed to ignore it.
The great state of Iowa, God's country, corn country!
Takian wondered how the man could keep up this kind of enthusiasm after so many ballots.
Casts 4 votes for Senator Al Gore!
The Omni Convention Center made Takian think of a giant funnel. People, like tiny grains of spices, all clinging to the precipitous sides, while gravity tried to tumble them willy-nilly into the level area of the basketball court. It was an exaggeration, of course, but the facility did give the alien vertigo. Dribbling powdered sugar down his coat front, Takian hurriedly balanced his cruller on top of his coffee cup, snatched up his fountain pen, and jotted down the number, then glanced at the running totals in 5 columns, each headed by an initial. Gore was definitely floundering. Only a matter of time now. Hartman had crawled painfully to 1900. Tack drew the back of his hand across his gritty, aching eyes. His session with the Secret Service had lasted until 5. By then, it seemed pointless to go to bed.
Your boy's in trouble, said Connie Chung, sliding into a folding chair behind him. The headset with its antenna made her look like a lopsided insect.
My boy, as you put it, is doing just fine. Once Gore drops out,
you're going to be in for a rude shock.
What do you mean? Asked Tack, alarmed.
He's faced with a choice between 3 northern liberals and a conservative southerner. I mean, what do you think?
No, said Tack with loathing.
She brushed sugar from his chin.
You really are a baby at this, Doctor. Watch and learn.
She started away, then looked back and added, Oh, by the way, Gore's called a press conference for 10 o'clock.
The phone rang during Jack's first Camel of the day. For a moment he couldn't find his briefcase, then discovered it under the coffee table. He picked up the receiver and collapsed on the couch. His caller was Amy Sorensen. We're in trouble. Greg wants your ass over here. Jack stared at the ceiling through gummed eyes. What's the problem? Gore's called a press conference for later this morning. He's dropping out, and he's gonna tell his people to support Barnett. That cocksucker, that yuppie cocksucker. For once, Jack wasn't conscious of using bad language in front of a woman. He jumped off the couch, knocking the coffee table halfway across the room. He's gonna be Barnett's Veep, right? Looks that way. Prince Albert in a fucking can. And some wildcard talent carved up a member of the Fourth Estate in Peachtree Mall last night. So guess who's gonna be capitalizing on it? Just get over here. The staff meeting couldn't resolve anything, except to hold on and hope for defections. Gore's endorsement couldn't be anything but the result of some major payoff, and it might offend some of his followers who couldn't stomach Barnett. Hartman gained another 104 delegates on the fourth ballot, so Jack's worst fears weren't realized. But Barnett picked up nearly 300, and the momentum was definitely his. On his little 2-inch Sony, Jack heard Dan Rather relate stories of party power brokers trying to form an anyone-but-Hartman movement. Speculations about a dream Dukakis-Jackson ticket were spiced with pointed reminders that Jackson had more delegates, and perhaps the ticket should be Jackson-Dukakis. Analysts wondered whether Jackson was willing to eat crow in order to be vice president. Apparently, he wasn't. The ABH movement, as Rather began calling it, seemed to remain the fantasy of a few party hacks in the Barnett campaign staff, who regarded anyone but Hartman as the equivalent of why not the fire breather? Anyone but Hartman. Jack couldn't believe he was hearing this. Why the hell wasn't it anyone but Barnett? A secret ace, he thought. Maybe there's a secret ace. The gremlins from the Kremlin, as an alternate hypothesis, was definitely losing ground.
At first it went well. Sarah could do this walking in her sleep. The mechanical interviews, stuff of every third Sunday supplement article and human interest story on the Tanktown 10 o'clock news. What's it like to be a joker in America? It wasn't good journalism. It was something she specifically despised. Families of dead shuttle astronauts. How does it feel to be raped reporting? But of course, this wasn't journalism at all. It was survival. It all went fine. Until she was recognized. The jokers camped in the park came from all over. California, Idaho, Vermont. Even a few from Alaska and Hawaii. While the better read of them would recognize her name, she was one of the premier writers on wildcard matters in the world, after all. She wasn't a broadcast journalist. Everybody knew Connie Chung's face. Nobody knew hers. That had always satisfied her. But there were a lot of her old buddies from J-Town here, too. She hadn't even thought what their reaction to her would be until a furred, taloned hand took her shoulder and spun her away from the joker mother and two desperately disparate children she was unspooling inanities from into a hot blast of spoiled meat predator's breath. "Just what do you think you're doing here?" a voice asked. The first panicked reaction was still echoing in the corridors of Sarah's brain. "It's him. I wish I had a gun. Dear God, Ricky, Ricky." When she recognized the person who'd accosted her. She was hard to mistake. 6 feet from the black, moist nose at the end of her wedge-shaped head to the tip of her tail, round-eared, bandit-masked, black-guard hairs over buff fur shading toward silver on her belly, like a Disneymation anthropomorphic ferret made real. The only thing she wore was a green vest studded with Hartman buttons and bitter Joker slogans. Why be normal? And JJS, and take a nat to lunch. Sarah knew her well. She should have been just another teenaged Italian girl wearing a dowdy blue plaid skirt to St. Mary's. She'd been busted for the first time at 14, during a free doughboy demonstration. "Mustelina," she said. "Hi, how are you?" "What do you think you're doing here, bitch?" Sarah recoiled from her vehemence. It was amazing how the Disney people always missed details like the 2-inch fangs curving from her upper jaw. "What do you mean?" The time she'd spent among jokers had inured her so she didn't flinch away from the girl's breath. Mustelina's joker had included a compulsive craving for live meat. Fortunately, there were a lot of rats in Joker Town. A crowd was accreting. Many of the jokers from the sticks were anonymous behind masks, but the J-Town contingent tended to parade its jokerhood, wearing disfigurements like proud stigmata. She recognized Glowbug and Mr. Cheese and Peanut with his hard-shelled stump and a strange look in his eye. They had been her friends. There was little friendship here now.
You know real well what I mean. You sold us to Barnett.
She blinked, tears starting hot. What are you talking about?
You're the one tried to smear Senator Gregg,
a southern voice said from behind a kabuki mask with eyebrows halfway up a domed white forehead.
You turned on Hartman, Mustelina said. You turned on us. You got a lot of nerve coming here like this.
Yeah, traitor, somebody else called. Nat! Fucking Jew, bitch!
She tried to back away. They hemmed her on all sides, the faces of grotesques by Goya and Hokusai and Bosch, hostile masks of feathers and plastic smooth as bone. Why did I come here? These are Hartman's people. Suddenly, Mustelina was snatched right out of her face and thrown 15 feet. She curled into a ball, rolled, came up bottling and popping like a string of firecrackers. A vast white figure loomed over the incipient mob. It held out a chubby hand, pallid and shiny as uncooked dough.
Come on, Thera, it lisped in the voice of a black child. I'll take you where it's safe.
She clung to the hand. Doughboy started forward with his rolling gait and Sarah at his side. The crowd gave back. He was nonviolent. He also weighed in at upwards of 600 and had the strength of 3 or 4 Nat men. In his own way, he was quite irresistible.
I saw you on Mekano's television, Doughboy said. You were saying terrible things about the senator. Everybody said you were a traitor.
She looked up at him. His face was an unpitted moon. He smiled without lips or teeth.
You are my friend, Thera. I knew you'd never do nothing wrong.
She hugged him. She also kept walking. This was an ideal place for Hartman's marionette to hit her, it had belatedly occurred to her. For that matter, if it hadn't been for Doughboy's arrival, his work might just have been done for him. Some of the crowd was still trailing along behind.
Will you bring me some candy sometime, Miss Sarah?
Doughboy asked.
Nobody brings me candy since Mr. Thioner went away.
He stopped at the street and faced her.
When will Mr. Thioner come back? Do you think he'll come back soon?
He's not coming back, honey, she said gently. You know that. It had been a stroke, that January. Doughboy found him paralyzed on his mattress in their little Eldridge Street apartment, carried him through the streets weeping and begging for someone to help fix Mr. Shiner. He reached Jokertown Clinic before an ambulance with a heavy enough suspension to carry him could be found. Nobody was going to try to separate him from his friend and guardian. By that time, there was nothing even Dr. Tachyon could do. Tears rolled from Doughboy's button eyes.
I miss him. I miss him so.
She reached up. She wasn't tall enough. He bent over until she could wrap her arms around his neck.
I know you do, honey, she said through her own tears. Thank you for helping me. I'll bring you candy soon. I love you.
She kissed his cheek and walked quickly away without looking back.
11 a.m. Doctor. He studied the handsome, dark face, the intense eyes actively scanning the lobby of the Marriott, missing nothing. Tack bowed slightly.
Reverend.
Deserting the floor of the convention?
Too chaotic.
And disappointing? Suggested Jesse Jackson softly.
It will be all right.
Tack cocked his head speculatively.
And you, entering the stronghold of the enemy?
Gregg Hartman is not my enemy.
Then you would have no objection to dropping out and handing your delegates to the senator?
Jackson laughed. Doctor, you beat me to the punch. May we talk?
He indicated a sofa near one wall of the upper lobby. AP, Time, the Sun-Times, and the Post began circling like barracuda. Straight Arrow, the Mormon ace from Utah, and Jackson's ace bodyguard eyed them with an unblinking stare. The news of Tachyon's bombshell had spread quickly through the security forces. To Tachyon's knowledgeable eye, the lobby seemed filled with discreetly armed men.
Wouldn't your suite be more private? Asked the Dakesian dryly.
The flash of white teeth behind the mustache.
Private is not what I'm after. Let him speculate.
Tachyon debated, decided that perhaps he and the Reverend Jackson could use one another.
Some might speculate that Tachyon's support of Hartman was wavering. Others might decide that Jackson was about to endorse Hartman.
They settled onto the sofa, the tall black man, the diminutive alien with one leg tucked up beneath him.
I want you to transfer your support to me, said Jackson bluntly.
Just like that.
Just like that, I'm the logical candidate to represent the Jokers and Aces. Together we can build a new world.
I have been here 42 years, Reverend, and I'm still waiting for that new world.
You must not give in to cynicism, pessimism, and despair, Doctor. I hadn't expected that from you. You're a fighter, like me.
Tachyon didn't speak, and Jackson went on.
We have the same interests.
Do we? I want to see my people protected. You want to be president.
Help me become president, and then I can protect your people, my people too.
He frowned at the far wall.
Doctor, my foreparents came to America on slave ships. You came here in a spaceship, but we're in the same boat now. If Barnett becomes president, we all suffer.
Tachyon shook his head more in confusion than negation.
I don't know. Greg Hartman has been our friend for 20 years. Why should I abandon him now? Help me. Kill me. Believe me.
He ruthlessly silenced the voices.
Because he can't win. The senator is stalling. My people are reporting anyone but Hartman coalition springing up all over the convention. If Greg Hartman can't stop Leo Barnett, Michael Dukakis certainly cannot.
And you can.
That self-confident grin that had galvanized a country, like an arc light in its intensity.
Yes, I can.
The smile faded, and he stared intently down at Tachyon.
I understand. I know abandonment, and people being mean to you and saying you're nothing and nobody and can never be anything. I understand.
His hand gripped the Dakesian's shoulder. Tachyon laid his hand over Jackson's, the same perfectly manicured nails, the same long, slender fingers, but white on black.
Why is it when you and Barnett are reputed to serve the same God, your gods are so different?
A good question, Doctor. A very good question.
A flying ace glider sighed softly onto the tile at Tachyon's feet. He picked it up, stroked the molded white scarf with a forefinger. Jackson stared at the painted black face. His hand rose reflexively, and he drew his fingers down his cheek.
Is your reluctance to back me entirely due to your loyalty? Or is it because I'm black?
Tack's head snapped up.
Burning sky, no, he rose. Believe me, Reverend, if I should ever decide to transfer my support from Greg Hartman, you would be my first choice. You see, you have a charisma that is almost Dakesian in its magnitude.
Jackson smiled.
And I take it that's a compliment.
Of the highest, Reverend. Of the highest.
12 noon. Greg's room service lunch sat untouched and cold on the coffee table of the suite. A Sony blared unheeded, and Tachyon sat like some damn wooden god on the couch. Dangerously near the surface, Greg could hear Puppet Man's voice, mingled with Gimli's mocking laughter. It took all his concentration not to lose himself in the subliminal chatter and say something that would reveal the conflict underneath. Worst of all, Greg was afraid that Puppet Man might start speaking out loud again. He paced restlessly in front of the windows. The entire time he could feel Tachyon's violet gaze on him, judging, appraising, cool. Greg knew he was talking too much, but the motion and the monologue seemed to help keep Puppet Man down. Barnett's up another 100 votes in the last ballot. 100 votes! We've gained what, 20? 25? Someone's got to start plugging the holes, Doctor. Hell, Charles said he'd talked to Gore's staff and was told Gore was planning to stay in. That was just last night, for Christ's sakes. Barnett must have promised him the damn VP spot in return for the delegates. We've got half the press yapping about an anyone but Hartmut movement, which means some of the on-the-fence delegates are going to start believing it. Barnett's already benefited from that garbage. Dukakis is back there smiling and shaking hands and waiting for the deadlock or a deal. I know all this, Senator, Tachyon said. There was a trace of impatience in his voice as he folded delicate hands on his lap. Then let's start doing something about it! Damn it! The alien's cool haughtiness made Greg's temper flare, and Puppet Man rose with the irritation. No, idiot, he told the power. Not with him, here, of all people, please! I'm doing what I can, Tachyon said with clipped, precise words. Browbeating those who support you isn't likely to get you anywhere, Senator. Especially not among your friends. Greg had no friends, no confidants, unless he counted Puppet Man. He suspected Tachyon was the same. They called each other friend, but it was mostly the residue of a political-social relationship that went back to the mid-60s, when Greg was a councilman and later mayor of New York. Greg had performed favors for Tachyon. Tachyon had done the same for him. They both affected the politics of the liberal, the left. That far, they were friends. Tachyon was an ace. Greg was afraid of aces, especially aces who could read minds. He knew that if Tachyon suspected the truth, the alien would not hesitate even one moment in revealing Greg to the public. So much for friendship. The thought made Greg angrier yet. Then let's talk frankly, as friends, Greg shot back. The talk is all over the convention. You've been chasing Fleur van Rensselaer like some horny teenager. There are things here more important than your gonads, Doctor. Greg had never dared to speak to Tachyon that way before, not to a person with such a formidable mind power, not with Puppet Man lurking in his head. Tachyon flushed a deep red. He rose to his feet with swift, offended dignity. Senator, he began, but Greg wheeled around with a chopping motion of his hand. No, Doctor, no. Greg's anger was a glowing coal stuck in his chest. He wanted to use his fist on the prissily dressed man and see that fine aristocratic nose flatten and splatter blood over the frilly satin shirt. Greg gritted his teeth to keep from shouting in fury, from backhanding Tachyon's arrogant face. He ached to kick the man in his goddamn alien balls. It wasn't only Tachyon. It was the whole friggin' day. The way his momentum had come to a wheezing halt on the convention floor, the eternal gnawing of Puppet Man, the chortling of Gimli, Mackie's failures in New York and here since Chrysalis's death, Ellen, everything. For just a moment, he wondered if Puppet Man hadn't fanned the embers. The thought cooled him. He grimaced. I need you. You can pretend to be just a correspondent, but everyone knows better. You're a very, very visible supporter, he told Tachyon. Everyone is extremely aware of your help with my campaign and our stand on the wildcard issues. How does it look to the rest of the convention if the good doctor is obviously more concerned about getting laid than with making sure his candidate is nominated? Priorities, Doctor, priorities. Tachyon took a deep breath in through his nose, lifting his chin. I don't need to be lectured like some errant child. Not by you, Senator, and especially not after I spent the entire morning working for you. I find your accusations extremely distasteful. How distasteful will it be if Barnett is the next president, Doctor? He may pretend to be compassionate, but we all know what will happen. Do you think you'll still have funding for your clinic? Is what will happen to the jokers then worth a few minutes of grunting passion between a woman's legs? Senator, Tachyon uttered in outrage. Greg laughed, and the sound had a manic cutting edge. He was sweating. His Brooks Brothers shirt ringed under the arms. Doctor, I'm sorry. I apologize for offending you. I'm being blunt because I'm concerned. For me, yes, but also for the jokers. If we lose here, everyone affected by the wild card loses too. You understand that, I know. Tachyon's lips were a thin, bloodless line. The angry flush lurked on his high cheekbones. I understand. Better than anyone, Senator. It would do you good to remember that. He spun on his toes in a graceful ballet turn and strode quickly to the door. Greg thought that he'd stop and say more, but Tachyon simply walked out, nodding to Billy Ray, stationed outside. Not even a fucking exit line, someone said in Greg's voice. Greg wasn't sure who it was that spoke.
1 p.m. A scuffle had broken out between a member of the New York delegation and an old woman from Florida. The two women had gone from shoves to the teeth bared and hands and claws stage. Hiram, blood suffusing his face, eyes almost popping with fury, flung chairs aside and rolled toward them. At the tiered wedding cake podium, Jim Wright was banging desperately and ineffectually. He gaped as the head broke clean off the gavel and went sailing away into the crowd. Tachyon, end running through the milling throng, saw Hiram clench his fist, then an indescribable expression washed across the ace's face, leaving his expression as blank as a beach after a retreating wave. The plump, manicured hand fell open and hung limply at his side. The old bat was wearing a Barnett button and a large wooden cross. For an instant, the Takesian hesitated. Then, seeing the sharp toe of the Florida delegate's shoe lifting for a kick, he threw caution to the wind and mind-controlled the both of them. The press arrived. Security arrived. Fleur arrived.
How dare you! Let her go!
Fleur dropped her arm protectively over the Barnett delegate's shoulder. Tack noted that Hiram had a grip on the New York madam. He bowed jerkily.
With pleasure. Just don't let her hit me.
Oh my God! He crawled in my mind! He polluted me! Alien!
Madam, I make it a point never to pollute ladies of your age and situation with my precious alien fluids or my precious alien time.
Bastard!
Fleur swept the sobbing woman away. Hiram drew a hand across his brow.
Not tactful, Techie.
I'm not feeling very tactful. This is a disaster.
This overcrowding makes fights inevitable, said Hiram.
They settled into some empty chairs. Even Tack's knees were practically at his chin, so closely packed were the chairs. With a furtive glance for security or cameras, the Takesian unlimbered his flask. Hiram gulped down an enormous swallow of brandy, choked, and suddenly Tack was shivering in distress as tears started rolling down Worcester's fat cheeks to mat in the heavy black beard. Sobs shook the massive body. Tachyon threw his arms around Hiram, patting, rocking, soothing. A string of nonsense words, endearments, and reassurances poured from his lips. His own voice was jumping. The emotional storm passed, and Tack offered his handkerchief. Hiram touched his brow, lips with tentative fingers.
Sorry, sorry.
It's quite all right. We are all under such strain.
Tachyon, he has to win!
The alien glanced from the wild, staring eyes to Hiram's hands, closed vice-like around Tack's arms. The human's knuckles were turning white from the pressure. Tachyon lightly touched one hand and said very softly and very gently,
Hiram, please, you're hurting me.
Worcester released him like a sprung trap.
Sorry, sorry, Tachyon. We have to do whatever it takes, don't we? It's too important to leave to chance, to the goodwill of others. This is one time when the end may justify any means. Yes?
Eyes closed. Tachyon remembered Syria. jokers being stoned to death in the streets before the bored or avid eyes of the gnat passers-by. South Africa, a time not so very long ago, when it wasn't considered a crime to rape a joker woman, just a lapse in taste. Yes, Item, maybe you're right. Patting the restaurateur absently on the shoulder, Tack went in search of Charles Devon. What he was considering, no, committed to doing, was insane. Certainly unfair. But when had a Dickesian ever been concerned with fair play? No sense approaching committed Barnett delegates. That would only arouse suspicion, and the effects might not last. But the uncommitteds, if they had a change of heart after some fervent politicking from Devon and the oh-so-persuasive and oh-so-charismatic Dr. Takyan, and Michael Dukakis, he could afford to lose a few. His only hope now was to be selected as the vice presidential candidate.
It just seemed to sail down out of nowhere and into her hand. She barely had to move or will, and she was holding it. She walked down Harris studying it, a plastic JJ Flash Flying Ace glider, with holes carefully burned through its body and wings with a hot wire or rod. The face had been pen-blacked to oblivion with careful malice. A couple of little black kids were wandering past in the other direction, staring at all the funny people.
"What you got there, lady?"
asked the one in the Run DMC t-shirt. She looked at the thing in her hand without comprehension. "A fucking flying joker," she said.
The room wasn't as nice as the one he'd had at the Marriott. There were old wooden blinds instead of curtains. The bed springs creaked, and the pastel paint was peeling around the baseboards. The motel was 45 minutes from downtown, and he'd had to slip the desk clerk a 50 to get the room. Still, Spectre felt much more comfortable here. There was an all-night liquor store down the block and a burger place across the street. He was finishing up a greasy double meat, double cheese, and trying to come up with some kind of believable lies to tell Tony. He still had his Marriott room key, so getting into the hotel would be no trouble. They talk about old times mostly. At least, that was what he hoped. His life before drawing the Black Queen was a hopeless blur. He didn't think about his past much, and considered the future only slightly more. Mostly he thought about death. Not because he liked it, but it was hard not to. Death put everything else into insignificant perspective. If all the politicians and lawyers and corporate hotshots understood the Reaper the way he did, they'd never bother to get out of bed in the morning. Spectre picked up the phone, an old beige rotary model, and dialed the Marriott. After about 20 rings, there was an answer.
"Marriott Marquis."
The voice was curt and whiny. Probably the little jerk-off who'd been at the desk when he checked in. "Yes. Any messages for 1031? They put him on hold without so much as a one moment or let me check. Spectre drummed his fingertips on his thigh. They were probably making him wait on purpose. Worse, they might have figured out what happened to Baird and were tracing the call. That would take at least a minute or two. He'd wait a few more seconds.
"Yes. Mr. Calderoni says to meet him in the lobby at 6 this evening."
Click. "Fuck you too," Spectre said, wrapping the mouthpiece on the edge of the nightstand. He tossed the receiver into the cradle and headed for the bathroom. Why was it ritzy hotels hired assholes? The little clerk was moving up the list. His chances of living out the week were even slimmer than Hartman's.
3 p.m. The CNN glass press booth hung like a vision of heaven at the top of the center. Takyan labored wearily up the steps, mentally preparing for another round of talks with journalists, a strata of society that shared a good many traits with carrion birds, he decided bitterly. Must have a story, the more tragic, horrifying, terrifying, the better. Hartman's star, so bright at the beginning of this long campaign trail, seems to be sadly dimming in the white-hot fires of this Democratic convention. The unctuous commentator, mouthing the silly metaphor, but it seemed to be becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. The door to the press booth opened. Fleur emerged. The stairway suddenly became unbearably claustrophobic. They were going to meet face to face. It was unavoidable. Tachyon steeled himself. Suddenly Fleur's high heel slipped from beneath her and she pitched headlong down the stairs. Calf muscles burning with strain, Tack vaulted up the stairs and caught her just before her dark head connected with the concrete. Her chignon had jerked loose and strands of sable hair hung about her face. He righted her, and a few more hairpins fell pattering to the floor. Are you all right? Yes. Yes. She pressed a hand to her forehead, looking about in confusion. I could have been killed. His arms were still around her. She glanced down, raised hesitant eyes to his face. You're still holding me. My apologies. He began to withdraw. She laid her hand on his shoulder, holding him in place. Tachyon felt her thigh, firm beneath the silk skirt, weld itself to his. His cock stirred. You could have let me fall. It would have been natural after the way I treated you. I would never let you fall. Fingers as soft as butterflies explored his face, traced across his lips. You saved my life. You exaggerate. Fleur pressed her body to his. Tack groaned softly as his penis stiffened to rigid and aching attention. Suddenly she cupped his face between her hands and kissed him. All vestiges of control vanished. Tongue probing deep into her mouth, he gripped her buttocks. Their panting breaths set an odd counterpoint to the roll call droning up from the floor. Tack's hands played frenziedly across her body. Fleur broke away, struggled to rebutton her blouse. Tachyon gripped her trembling fingers. Here, let me. Take me to your room. He looked up, fingers frozen on a button. She lifted his hand, bit down hard on a forefinger. Help me. A cry from his soul? Or a random thought from Fleur? He ignored the plaintive voice. We can't be seen living together, whispered Fleur. He handed her his room key. I'll follow. Soon.
Jack's phone bleeped again. It had been ringing all through his lunch at the Bellomondo, and the other patrons were beginning to get annoyed. The Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, in fact, was scowling at him from the next table. Jack offered Jim Wright, of Texas, an apologetic look, opened his case, and took out the handset. This is Tachyon. I'm calling from the press room. I must leave, and I require someone here with your kind of charisma. What for, exactly? I will inform you when you arrive. Please, hurry. Hey, don't give me this Takesian royalty in a hurry crap. But Tachyon had hung up. Jack contemplated grinding the telephone to dust. Instead, he finished his last bite of dessert, overpaid, and fed the maitre d' his C-note. The distance from the Marriott to the convention center was precisely one unfiltered camel in length. Jack's neck prickled. He and Fleur van Rensselaer jostled in a door leading to the convention center. Psychos, his third wife had been a real nutcase, made him nervous. Despite the way Fleur spooked him, Jack gave her a jaunty wave and grin, received a closed-lipped smile in return. He saw a Marriott room key in her hand and figured she was heading to the hotel to give some reporter a blowjob straight from God, maybe convert him to Barnett's cause. Tachyon was waiting just beneath the ABC skybox, wearing his cavalier coat with the slashes and turnbacks. the riding breeches and boots. The alien's face was strained. When he saw Jack, the violet eyes flashed. What took you so long? Hi to you too. It's imperative that you speak to the press immediately, waving his plumed hat under Jack's nose. Fine. Jack tipped another cigarette out of the pack. What am I supposed to be talking to them about? If he's anyone but Hartman business. If the media keeps harping on this, it'll become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay, Jack grinned as he lit the Camel. Is Connie Chung in there? And if she's married, is her husband here? This is no time for... Taekyeon began waving the hat again, then abruptly swallowed his words. Color blossomed on his cheeks. At the sight, a cold, despairing certainty settled into Jack's mind. It's Fleur, right? That was your hotel key, she waved at me. She did not wave. The alien swallowed his words again. Taekyeon drew himself up to his full princely height, with the heels about 8 inches below Jack's, and glared with furious violet eyes. I will not have my personal life questioned. This is no affair of yours. Darn right it's no affair of mine. I turned her down a few days ago. Taekyeon showed his teeth. How dare you? Do you know who you're speaking to? Jack took a measured breath of smoke. I'm talking to someone who's being led around by his dick, which is pretty funny, considering how long it's been since you last got it up. Taekyeon flushed red with anger. Cold fear touched Jack's spine at the thought that he'd gone too far, that this was someone who had been raised to kill at the slightest insult, who had, in fact, once sworn to murder Jack and might decide that he'd ignored the vow for too long. But instead, Taekyeon just brushed past him, heading out of the convention center. Jack followed, his long legs keeping pace easily with the alien's quick step. Tack, okay, that wasn't fair, he said. The point is, Fleur did make a pass at me the other day. I don't believe you. Taekyeon spoke through clenched teeth, his boot heels tapping rapidly on the concrete. She's trying to embarrass the campaign. You know how much the whole Sarah Morgenstern business cost us. There might be half a dozen network cameramen behind a two-way mirror watching you when you screw. In my bedroom? Taekyeon's measured answer came out as a half-shriek. It's still a setup. Will you listen? He grabbed Taekyeon's arm. It's a fucking... Leave me alone! Wrenching his arm free. She's a psycho. She's not her mother, understand? She's not Blythe. Taekyeon stopped walking and spun to face Jack. His face was drained of color. Do not, he said, let that name pass your lips ever again. You have not earned that right. Jack stared at him, his annoyance turning to boiling anger. This was for your own good, he said. He stuck his cigarette in his mouth and picked Taekyeon up and put him under his arm. He started walking for the Omni Hotel while the alien kicked and struggled. Blood and bone! Let me down! I'm gonna find a cold shower and put you in it, Jack said. Consider it your penance for throwing that bomb at me in Paris. If you want to get laid after that, I know a Miss Peachtree who will be glad. Jack stopped moving. He put Taekyeon down. He marched up the ramp to the stair leading to the skybox. He dropped the cigarette to the concrete floor, ground it under his heel, and stepped in. Then he blinked, took a long breath, and tried not to collapse. Taekyeon had just shredded his mind like a newspaper torn by a high wind. Reporters waited, scattered around tables and looking bored. Some were staring at him. Summoning nerve from some place he didn't know he had, Jack gave them a smile and wave, and stepped forward to say his piece.
4 p.m. Would you like a drink?
No. Her arms were folded protectively across her breasts. He hefted the bottle. Alcohol was sometimes an inhibitor. He quickly replaced the bottle, hugged his elbows, stared at the floor. They were separated by feet. It might have been light years. Never had he felt so gauche. The hiss of silk brought his head up. Fleur's skirt puddled on the floor about her feet. She studied the far wall with frowning abstraction as she swiftly unbuttoned her blouse, unsnapped her bra. The heavy breasts swung free. She was larger bosomed than her mother had been. Taekyeon couldn't decide if he liked it. His mouth was dry from nerves.
He watched her buttocks dimple as she climbed into the bed.
Wait, he forced out.
Let's do this. As a come online, it lacked something. He jammed his hands into his pockets, took a quick turn about the room. He noted his erection was back.
I'm scared.
Propping her elbows on her knees, hands hanging loosely between her legs in front of her dark snatch, Fleur said dryly, That's my line.
Help me a little.
How?
Undress me. Be loving with me.
She swung off the bed and took hold of the lace cravat at his throat, unbuttoned his shirt, and pushed it off his shoulders. Tack, standing with closed eyes, could feel her hair brushing at his skin. The scent of vanilla and spice washed across him. Shalimar. Blythe's scent. It brought it all back so strongly. That hot summer day in 48. The crackle of petticoats as he embraced Blythe. The smell and taste of Shalimar as his lips explored her neck. Fleur slithered down the length of him like a worshiper at some ancient altar. Her lips were pressed to his belly as she opened his pants and pulled them down over his hips. His erection throbbed in time to his beating heart. In a frenzy, he kicked off his shoes and struggled to free himself from the confining material of his pants. Fleur laughed, husky and low, as he lost his balance and sprawled on the floor, kissing, clutching, panting, punctuating the desperate flow of endearments with deep groans, they lurched toward the bed. A single bead of sperm squeezed from the head of his cock. Terrified that he would lose it, Tachyon spread her legs, murmuring Tachyon obscenities like a pagan litany. The lips of her labia closed about him. The touch of her mind. Roulette. Poison. Death. Terror. Madness. He began to lose it, the iron leaching from his penis. Suddenly, other hands tangled in his long hair, a sweet husky voice encouraging him, the muted click of the beaded curtains blowing gently in a hot breeze, the scratchy recording of La Traviata throwing sound like shards of light throughout the apartment, Blythe in his arms. He drove deep within her, gave a shrill cry of triumph. Blythe, Blythe, Blythe.
6 p.m. Night was coming. She was sure of it. Sitting beneath a potted plant's notched ear in the Marriott lobby, she could feel it slouching, rough beast-like, toward downtown Atlanta. When it came, it would thin the crowd, remove, one by one, the forest of walking, talking trees in which she hid, until there was no cover. It was simple mathematics. If safety was numbers, subtraction equaled death. Night was the natural environment of Hartman's hunchbacked puppet. She knew that, as she knew night would soon or late be born. She had to find an indivisible one to protect her, or the creature that clung to the fur of night's black belly would have her. Tachyon had failed her. So had Ricky, though his failure had been of the noble variety, and had bought her 24 hours of airtime. She had to find someone with the strength to shield her, someone who would accept the only coin she had to pay with, before Day's placenta burst. She knew just the man.
The band was playing Stars Fell on Alabama, which Jack hoped to hell wasn't some kind of political signal. After 11 futile ballots, almost anything could be taken for an omen by weary and desperate delegates. Jack hoped the song was only a crowd soother after the day's seventh fistfight on the floor, this last between a Jackson delegate defecting to Hartman and a floor manager who was trying to change his mind. There was a motion on the floor to give up and go home for the day, something that was perfectly in tune with the delegate's premature wariness. Jack moved through his crowd to find Rodriguez. Listen, S.A., we've stayed solid for Hartman so far. Right. Everybody's gonna come after us tonight. One crack in the facade of solid California, and people are gonna figure it's open season. Sweat was pouring down Jack's face. There were sopping stains under the arms of his tailored shirt. At some point that afternoon, the air conditioners had given up. Call a meeting after dinner. 9 o'clock. Everyone attends. Rodriguez looked at him. What's the meeting about? Who gives a damn? We'll figure out something. We just need to count heads. Make sure none of the other guys' people are talking to ours. If we keep our delegates busy, we can keep them out of other people's camp. Rodriguez gave a grin. What you gonna do after that, man? Bed checks? Something like that. Rodriguez's grin faded. Jack spoke quickly. We're all blocked together at the Marriott. I want you to put someone you trust on each floor. Check people in and out. Make a list. Get IDs. We can't stop the wrong people from visiting ours, but we can make sure they're seen when they do. Rodriguez looked dubious. You've seen all the hookers outside. We're supposed to get their names? Just do it, Jack snapped. Damn, his temper was unraveling along with everyone else's. Barnett's people are trying to compromise us, he said, lowering his voice. One of their bimbos, for Christ, is fucking Tachyon even as we speak. Rodriguez looked horrified. Okay, he said. I'll see to it. Jim Wright looked relieved as he gaveled the convention to an early close, leaving the networks frantically trying to schedule hours of primetime reruns. Jack's temper growled in his mind as he crowded out the door. The whole thing had gone on too long. 2 days of balloting following 2 days of procedural fights, and all in the middle of a sweltering Georgia summer. Fleur Van Rensselaer was off fucking Tachyon, hoping to accomplish God knew what, and Tack had left Jack to face the media unprepared. Not only that, Connie Chung was clearly prepared to stay faithful to her husband. At least he had his table waiting at the Bello Mondo, and a whole night before him. It had been a week since he last got laid. He had nothing better to do tonight than rectify that oversight. There was another message from Bobby waiting for him at the desk, but there was no answer when he returned her call. He showered, changed, endured the horrors of the glass elevator as he descended from his room to the Bello Mondo. The waiter, recognizing him, brought his double whiskey without being asked. And then Sarah Morgenstern, looking like someone had recently connected her to a car battery, sat opposite him. She was clutching a shoulder bag to her chest as if it were all she owned. Mind if I join you? He looked at her. She wore clothes well, even the rumpled blue and white prom dress she had on at the moment. But her white blonde hair was disordered, and there was an unsteady look in her sunken eyes. I don't want to hear about it, Sarah, Jack said. Can I borrow one of your cigarettes? I'm feeling a little out of sorts. I saw a murder last night. The one in the mall? Sarah's hands trembled as they extracted a Camel. It was an ace, she said. A weird, twisted teenage kid. He cut Ricky to pieces, right in front of me. Jack decided they didn't want this woman's company for even a second. Sarah, he said. She looked up at him. There was too much makeup around her eyes, he noticed, trying to hide the effects of a sleepless night. The point is, she said, trying to smile, I don't want to be alone tonight. Which maybe changes matters, Jack thought. He reached into his jacket for his lighter and lit her cigarette. She inhaled and began coughing uncontrollably. Tears sprang to her eyes. Jesus, she said, what are these? The kind I learned to smoke in the army. I used to smoke Carlton's in college. I really shouldn't start again. Oh, hell. She stubbed the cigarette out as if driving a dagger into her worst enemy. Have a drink. It lasts longer. Jack signaled the waiter. At least, he thought nobly, he'd be taking this loose cannon out of play for a few hours. Maybe a whole night. All this and get laid, too. He looked at Sarah and an idea came to him. Maybe he could take her out of play for a lot longer than he first thought.
The North Expressway was jammed, but Tony jockeyed the Black Regal through it effortlessly. Spectre was glad they weren't eating at the Marriott. There was considerably less chance of someone recognizing him away from the hotel. Tony had on a tailored dark blue suit and matching tie. Spectre was in gray. His suit still smelled like the store. "Where are we headed?" Spectre asked. "La Grotta." Tony whipped across two lanes of traffic to take the Peachtree exit. "If I get us there alive. You'll love this place. Some of the best Italian food in town. Not New York, of course, but you go with what's available." "Yeah, well, thanks for taking time out. I know you're real busy right now." "I haven't seen you in ages, man. You get priority." Tony smiled. That smile had been turning women's hearts to goo and winning over men for as long as Spectre had known Tony. He was a hard guy not to like. "How did you wind up with Hartman?" Spectre wanted to keep Tony talking about himself. That way he wouldn't be asking many questions. Tony shrugged. "One improbability leading to another. I got a loan and managed to talk my way into law school, did some work in local politics, just happened to be on the winning side a few times. Somebody in Greg's camp noticed me and, well, I'm ethnic. That doesn't hurt. Plus, you're good. Always were. Good jump shot, good line for the girls." Spectre smiled. "Hell, you could talk a good Catholic girl out of her clothes in less time than it took the rest of us to comb her hair." "It's a sin to waste a God-given talent." Tony wagged his finger at Spectre. "And you know how I avoid sin, at all costs." "Right." Spectre glanced out the window. There were dark clouds gathering above the treetops, with patches of gray below, where the rain was already falling. "Looks like we might get wet." "My friend, for a meal like this, you'd swim the Hudson over to Teaneck." Tony made a contented sound. He looked over at Spectre and kissed the tips of his fingers. "Trust me." Thunder rumbled overhead. "I trust you, old buddy." Spectre wished he could say it was a two-way street.
7 p.m. He woke suddenly, filled with a sense of total well-being, or perhaps filled was not the proper description. Empty, floating, freed at last from 2 years of pressure and anxiety. Tack kicked free of the tangled sheets. The scent of sweat and sex hung heavy in the room. Realized with a thrill of disappointment that the bed was empty. Sat up, then relaxed back against the pillows at the flush of the toilet. Floor padded in, breasts swinging. She realized he was awake and her arms crossed over her chest. "Don't. I like to look at you." "You're a heathen." "Yes. You're a courtesan." She lifted the drapes and looked out. "That's not very nice." "It was meant to be a compliment. Why haven't you married?" "How do you know I haven't?" She leaned back against the window, one buttock cocked up on the narrow sill. "I don't read married off you." She stiffened. "Are you reading my mind?" "No." "You tried, the second time we did it." "I would have tried the first time, but I was too busy trying to make certain that I stayed firm." "Don't read my mind." "All right. It makes sex better for me, but all right. I think it's horrible that you can violate people that way." "Fleur, may I remind you that I didn't read your mind. I sensed your opposition and I withdrew. I am a very well-mannered person, not to mention charming and handsome and witty." There was no lightening of her somber expression, and he trailed away into embarrassed silence. He fumbled his flask off the bedside table and took a swig. "Your mother wanted so much for you. Husband, children, home, happiness. I don't want to talk about her." "Why not?" "It's old history." She slid into the bed, her hand reaching for his cock. "I want you in bed with me, not with her."
Spectre loosened his belt a notch. He'd had a salad and lamb stew.
Spezzatino de Montone, Tony had called it, sampling a bite to make sure it was up to par. Tony had eaten the chicken and almond dish with buttered rice on the side. They'd split a strudel with custard for dessert, and that had done it for Spectre. He wasn't used to eating this much, and could practically feel the food piling up at the back of his throat. Tony sighed. Did I tell ya? Just as good as advertised, Spectre drained what was left of the wine in his glass. We've been so busy eating that I haven't had a chance to ask you who you're lobbying for. Spectre tensed. So far they've talked about the old neighborhood, girls, basketball, what had happened to people. Tony had been his only good friend during his school years. It wasn't that people hated Spectre. They just didn't notice him. Tony was Mr. Charisma. They were unlikely friends, but close all the same. Tony's question reminded him that he was here to kill Hartman. He was an unavoidable fact. Well, let's just say my employers don't share all the same views as your senator. Spectre didn't want to lie, but he sure as hell didn't want to tell the truth either. Better to compromise. Tony nodded and rounded up a few stray crumbs of strudel with his fork. You don't want to talk about it, that's fine. You got any feelings about the wild card victims? I mean, personally? It's a tough break. Spectre knew that as well as anyone, having drawn the Black Queen himself. Only Tachyon had been stupid enough to bring him back. But there's lots of tough breaks. Some people just get a few more than others. Don't you think jokers are getting kicked around, though? Tony was looking hard at Spectre. He had a stake in this somehow. Something that went beyond political attitudes. Sure. But what are you going to do about it? Spectre picked up the bottle of Pinot Nero and poured himself another glass. Make sure their rights are protected just like any other American citizen? That's what I want. That's why I'm working for Hartman. Tony sat silently for a moment. Don't think that's too much to ask, do you? Spectre shook his head. No. I've been around a lot of jokers, but it's different with them. Blacks, Italians, whoever else. They all still look like people. It's not their own fault. But plenty of jokers look like they should be in a zoo. Most people react with their guts, not their brains. Spectre knew he'd always gone with his instincts. If he hadn't gotten the virus himself, he'd probably hate the jokers like the rest. Tony tossed his napkin on the table and signaled the waiter to bring the bill. You got time to take a little ride with me? Sure, Spectre said, downing his wine. What have you got in mind? Just gonna visit some friends of mine, good friends. I'd like you to meet them. Tony smiled again. Spectre couldn't say no. Maybe after we're done, you can introduce me to your boss. I'd like to meet him. Spectre was uncomfortable, and it wasn't entirely due to his bloated stomach. We might just be able to do that, Tony said. But first things first. Right, Spectre thought. First things first.
All of his old skills had returned. His aspect was truly upon him. Tachyon grinned down at his penis, thrusting aggressively from the copper hairs of his brush. Laughing, he dove between her legs, nipping at her thighs, licking, teasing. Only one thing remained: to join completely with her. To join with her mind. He would do it when they climaxed, he decided. That would forever put the terror of roulette behind him. Wriggling up her body, he sucked in one dusky nipple, penetrated her. Her thoughts were sharp, as jagged as glass.
You look just like your mother, and she was a slut. Slut! Slut!
A hateful voice. He hadn't heard it in 38 years. Even filtered through the layers of Fleur's memories, Henry Van Rensselaer still had the power to disgust.
You better prove how much you love me.
I love you, Daddy. I love you. The soft cadences of Leo Burnett. Open your heart to Jesus, and all your sins will be forgiven you. The rest followed in swift, hurtful images. Fleur's realization of how he was using his power on the uncommitted delegates. The faked fall. The pretended passion. The disgust and dislocation as she tried to come to grips with the fact that she was in bed with her mother's lover. Even as she clutched at his sweat-slick body, she was pretending that he was Leo Burnett. Fury took him, and Takian was closer to striking a woman than he'd ever been in his life. He took his revenge by finishing the act with her, slaking his body's desires with hired meat. And when it was over, he rolled out of the bed, and gathering up her clothes, tossed them on top of her. She stared at him, alarm shadowing the brown eyes.
Get out.
You read my mind.
Yes.
You violated me.
Yes.
She was scrabbling into her clothes, wadding up her hose and cramming them into her purse, smoothing the tangled hair, pausing at the door she flung at him.
I accomplished what I set out to do. I kept you away from the convention.
And you deserve something for your trouble.
Takion dug out a pair of 20s and slapped them into her hand.
Jack was right. You're not your mother. You are a slut.
She slammed the door behind her. The air conditioning was icy on his bare skin. Tak poured himself a drink and took several deep breaths, trying to slow his racing heart. Then, as he lifted the glass to his lips, the door hit the wall with a report like a firing pistol. Brandy sloshed across his chest and belly.
Oh, ideal.
Expecting someone?
Remarked Polyakov dryly as he eyed Takion's erection. But there was a narrowness to the eyes, a tension to the jaw that made Takion think that the Russian's mind was anywhere but on Takion's sex life.
If you could return your brains from your secondary head to your primary head, may we discuss a very serious problem.
Very funny. Tak padded to the dresser,
poured a fresh drink. Blaze settled cross-legged on the bed and stared down at his hands. George stood solid and lumpish in the center of the room.
So what is this great and serious problem?
We were arrested.
What?
Tak turned like a slow, coiling snake on Blaze.
What did you do?
Nothing, he whined.
Oh, no.
Just played master puppeteer with a joker, a Klansman, a neo-Nazi, and a policeman, snapped Polyakov.
Tak shook his head like a baffled pony. George continued grimly on.
You would think when he has a subtle and invisible power, he would have the brains not to advertise when he is using it.
Something flickered between man and boy. Suspicious, Tak lanced out with his telepathy. But all he caught was the brittle edges of the passing thoughts, the flavor of conspiracy.
They were all standing out there waving their dicks at each other. I was just giving them the opportunity to prove how tough they were. That stupid, ugly joker was trying to wimp out. Shut up!
Even Takion jumped at the fury and command in the Russian's voice. Polyakov turned his back on the red-faced boy.
The preambulations of an adolescent, super-powered Caligula are not a problem. The problem is Henry Chaikin.
Fascinating. And who by the ideal is Henry Chaikin?
An AP reporter who used to be stationed overseas. He recognized me as Viktor Demyanov, reporter for TASS.
Blood and ancestors.
Tak's knees felt weak, and he felt for the edge of the bed, sat down hard.
Naturally, the police.
Frustrated with the slow unraveling of the story, Takion snatched the memory from his grandson's mind. The street flanking Piedmont Park, glancing down to see the dusty footprints left by his tennis shoes on the hood of the car. The circle of sweating faces surrounding the little tableau, mouths stretched with excitement, eyes glistening, shrugging off George's clutching hands.
Come on, come on, put your money down! Not on an ugly joker, he's going to get creamed!
The cop giving a convulsive jerk as Blaze twitched the cord binding the human to the Quartertakesian child.
He's not going to help that joker. He hates them too, I know. I mean his head.
Soon after, an army of police arrived, and Blaze discovered the limit to his power, continued Polyakov, not realizing that Tachyon had read it all.
A chill, like an icy finger, traced on his back as Tak considered that at the end, Blaze had been controlling 9 people. Tachyon's limit was 3 for full control, and that took a tremendous toll on mind and body. 9, and he was only 13, and I've been training him. His eyes met the flat, implacable gaze of the sullen boy.
Chekin was an interested spectator to all of this, and he found it interesting that my current identification did not match his memory of me. I gave him a story about changing my name as I changed my life, but if they are not complete fools, they will check.
Your papers
are very good, but I questioned it to the wrong place, a photo shown to the wrong man.
Polyakov shrugged expressively.
You have to get out of here, out of the country. If you need money, I will give it to you.
No, I came here to do a thing. I will not leave.
What about me?
You don't matter any more than I do. What I do out of a perhaps pathetic belief in an ideal. A familiar concept to you, Tachyon. You curse with it, believe in it. We're not so very different. We both have our honor. Unfortunately, it is always purchased with blood.
There was again that fleeting glance between the Russian and Blaze. Tachyon slipped beneath the teenager's imperfect shields.
You may not use Blaze. I forbid it.
An infinitesimal arch of the eyebrows, Polyakov's mouth twisted in a slight, bitter smile.
I will do whatever Uncle George wants, shrilled Blaze.
I will kill you first, said Tachyon, eyes locking with the Russians. I am not your enemy, Dancer. He is.
A pudgy forefinger thrust at the ceiling and the Hartman suite 7 floors above.
8 p.m. Standing with the fronds of a fern falling across his face like bangs, Mackie Messer watched Sarah and the Big Fuck leave the restaurant. She'd been keeping him at bay all day, keeping to the crowds, never letting him have a shot at her alone. He'd thought surely she'd go to the room she shared with the nigger to take a shower. Women were crazy about keeping clean. He'd never seen Psycho, so he didn't realize that was the last thing a woman of Sarah's generation would do in circumstances like these. The memory of offing the natty nigger made his lips smile. It had felt good, his hand on bone. But the rush had faded. He was hungry. He hadn't spotted Sarah till mid-morning, over in the Joker Park. He hadn't even had a chance to phase into some restaurant's kitchen and rip off a bite to eat. Hunger was feeding the frustrated anger that had been building in him all day.
The bitch! I have to kill her! I can't let the man down!
He was going to have to do something soon. Something violent, to let out all that feeling. And now she and her new boyfriend headed for the elevators, arm in arm, going upstairs to fuck. Women were all alike. He followed, weaving among delegates who didn't deign to notice a twisted boy. Got to the elevator stand in time to see them go into one and the doors close. He laughed out loud.
Yeah, baby, baby.
All he had to do now was see what floor they got off on. Then, he'd find them. He licked his lips. I hope they're doing it when I catch them. He thought of the man's big cock going into Sarah, and his hard hand going into him, and almost creamed his jeans.
Drinks, exhaustion, and a heavy meal had done their work on Sarah. Her knees had gone rubbery, and she leaned on Jack as they shot upward in the glass elevator. Jack closed his eyes against a surge of vertigo. Then he thought of the bottle of Valiums in his luggage and gave an inward smile. Sarah was clearly on her last legs. She'd be out like a light within hours. And sometime toward morning, Jack was going to creep out of bed, find the Valiums, crumble a couple of them in a glass of room service orange juice, and feed them to her with breakfast. That, he thought, should keep the loose cannon from rolling around for most, if not all, of Friday. Jack led Sarah along the curving atrium balcony, then down a short hallway to his suite. "Piano Man" echoed up from the floor of the atrium. Sarah stepped through the door and stood there, her heavy shoulder bag pulling her off balance. Jack put the Do Not Disturb sign on the door, closed and locked it, and put his arms around Sarah from behind. Despite the alcohol, her body was taut as a watch spring. He brushed the disordered hair from her neck and began to kiss her nape. For a while, Sarah didn't react. Then she gave a sigh and turned toward him. He kissed her on the lips. She took her time about responding. Finally put her arms around his neck, opened her mouth, let his tongue flicker against hers. "There," Jack said, grinning. "It's better when you help." Which was the line that Bacall gave Bogart in To Have and Have Not. Sarah didn't smile. "I've got to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back, okay?" Jack watched her walk unsteadily toward the toilet. A sinking feeling was beginning to envelop him. This was playing too much like his second marriage. He took off his jacket and poured himself a whiskey. He could hear water running in the bathroom, then silence. Maybe she was fixing her hair or makeup. Maybe she was sitting on the commode, reliving the death of her friend. Jack lit a cigarette and thought about the first time he'd seen violent death, when his company was caught in a German counterattack down Highway 90 between Avellino and Benevento, and he remembered that the experience hadn't made him feel very sexy either. Damn, he thought. This had the potential to be a very depressing night. The bathroom door opened and Sarah gave him a brave smile as she came into the room. She'd fixed her hair and makeup and looked quite different from the scarecrow who'd sat opposite him at dinner. Jack stubbed out the cigarette and walked toward her. He was about to take her in his arms when a young hunchback in a leather jacket walked right through the wall behind her, grinned, and lunged forward with a hand thrust out like a spear. Without thought, Jack picked Sarah up, made a half turn, and tossed her gently onto the sofa behind him. The air burned with Jack's golden light. There was the shrieking sound of a buzzsaw hitting a spike buried in a tree, a sound that brought Jack's hackles erect and sent a surge of adrenaline pouring through his body. Jack turned back to the intruder and saw a look of shock on his young, pale face. Jack flipped a fist at the little man, a gentle backhand strike, and in a flare of yellow light, the leather boy was flung against the bathroom wall with a bone-breaking crash. The boy dropped to the floor like a rag doll. Sarah screamed as she turned and saw the assassin. Jack jumped involuntarily. "I got him, Sarah," Jack said. She kept on screaming. He heard the sounds of her struggling to her feet. Jack stepped forward toward the leather boy and leaned over him. The boy's eyes snapped open and his hands sliced out, flashing as if they were knives. And when they connected with Jack, there was a flare of golden light, the screaming buzzsaw noise, and bits of Jack's clothing flying like the fur of a fighting cat. Jack didn't even feel the blows. He picked up the boy by his leather jacket and held him at arm's length. The hunchback, as if he couldn't believe what was happening, kept hacking at Jack's arm, cutting the pale blue Givenchy shirt to ribbons. Apparently, the little guy hadn't ever come up against an invincible opponent before. "Kill him!" Sarah's voice. "Jack, kill him now!" Jack thought not. He wanted to knock this character out and find out who he was working for. He aimed a slow, open-hand slap at the boy's head, one that would maybe put him out for a few hours. The slap went through the hunchback's head without connecting. His other hand, holding the boy's jacket bunched up under his chin, was suddenly holding nothing at all. A dazed, triumphant grin passed across the boy's face as he drifted slowly, not dropped, toward the floor. "Jack," Sarah wailed, Jack, oh Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. An edge of fear grated across Jack's nerves. He flicked out punches, one, two, and both passed through the boy without touching him. The boy's feet touched the floor. His grin twisted, and he dove forward, his body passing right through Jack, heading for Sarah. Jack spun and went after him. Sarah was stumbling backward toward the door, holding her shoulder bag out protectively. The boy's hands sliced forward, hacking the bag in half with a ripping noise, like heavy cardboard torn by a buck knife. Jack grabbed the hunchback's leather collar and jerked back with all his strength. The boy went insubstantial before his feet quite left the floor, but Jack had managed to impart a certain momentum, and the boy sailed upward and back. Jack saw the pale face redden with fury as it disappeared through the ceiling. The lower part of his body remained visible as it shot back, then down. Jesus, Jesus! Sarah was clawing at the hall door, trying to unlock it. Oh, fuck! Jack had worked it out. The boy had to become substantial in order to use his buzzsaw hands. He was most vulnerable when he tried to kill him. It had been so much easier when all he had to do was grab cars full of fugitive Nazis and turn them upside down. Sarah got the door open and disappeared, screaming into the hall. The leather boy soared back, his head appearing now, and Jack swiped at him a few times just in case he tried to turn himself solid again. The hunchback kept sailing, went through the wall into Jack's back bedroom. Hell, Jack said. He contemplated going through the wall after him and decided against it. He might get hung up partway through. He ran for the bedroom door and smashed through it in a bright flash of light. He saw the leather boy solid and on his feet, racing for the wall that led to the corridor outside. The assassin went insubstantial and dove through the wall head first. Hell, Jack said again, reversed himself, ran for the hallway door. The boy was just ahead of him. Sarah wasn't visible, had probably run out onto the atrium balcony by now. Don't cry for me, Argentina, soared up from the ground floor. Jack accelerated, swung a fist, missed the back of the boy's neck by inches. The momentum of the punch threw Jack off course and caromed him off the wall, and the boy drew ahead. He must have heard Jack behind him, because as he reached the atrium balcony, he turned, grinning his crazed grin. One buzzsaw hand, just for demonstration purposes, sliced a chunk of concrete out of the balcony wall. Jack was still moving forward with considerable momentum. He planted his feet in front of the kid and used his forward motion to torque his upper body forward, his right hand punching out toward the hunchback's chest with every ounce of strength he possessed. The assassin went insubstantial. The power of Jack's punch carried him over the balcony rail in a blaze of golden light.
She ran out the door and down the hallway because the stairwell had been closing in around her, about to grow an arm that would slice her in two. The terror was a solid lump in her throat. She had no idea where she was going. A distant part of her mind observed that just now panic was her friend, because she had no place to go, logically, and panic was better than despair. I should just go back and offer my throat, she thought wildly. But her legs kept pumping.